Welcome to Unspeakable, Episode 2, the official podcast of the Unspeakable Oath magazine. My name's Torin Atkinson. I'm the lead singer for The Darkest of the Hillside Thickets. I'm the co-host of Caustic Soda, the podcast, and I'm an illustrator that you may have seen in the most recent issues of the Unspeakable Oath. And with me today, as always, Shane Ivey.
Hi there. It's still me.
You're the editor of The Unspeakable Oath, I understand.
Yeah. I edit The Oath, and I've sort of spearheaded bringing it back to ye live waste awfulness. So I run Arcstream Publishing with Dennis Detweller, and we do Cthulhu books as well as Arcstream's other things.
With me also is host of the role-playing public radio podcast, Ross Payton, and also author of Zombies of the World.
Not to mention Road Trip, a Monsters and Other Childish Things campaign, which you can vote for at the Innies Award until July 24th, I believe. So vote for Road Trip and Delta Green and the Unspeakable Oath. Mostly Road Trip. So,
when is this podcast coming out? Is that going to be before or after said any awards?
Well, the voting is going on for another week or so as we record this now. So whether the podcast is out by the time voting is up, I don't know. We can shoot for that. That'd be handy.
Yeah. No, I believe it's the 24th. It goes on for July till 15th to the 24th. So if you're hearing this before July 24th, 2011, then go to anniesawards.com/vote.
I'll be there.
It's been very cool. We our Arcstream has 5 nominations this time around, and so we've got one for Road Trip in Best Adventure, and the Unspeakable Oath is nominated for Best Accessory, and Delta Green Targets of Opportunity is up for Best Adventure as well, and for Best Writing, and then our Wild Talents book Progenitor by Greg Stolze is up for Best Setting. So everybody who's listening to this, you need to drop everything and go to and go look up the address for voting and vote for those things. And vote one. Don't like vote 5 because it's 5 times awesomer, because low is better on their scale.
Yes. Oh, I've had more than one. I've had a friend tell me that. Yeah. Made that mistake as well.
I gave you a 5, man.
Yeah. And it's the one vote per IP address.
You're the fifth best.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how
well,
it
if you
is.
Give everything else a 0, it's better than nothing, but, you know.
right.
This is true.
Yes, we'll wait for you, the listener, to go and do that. Press pause on your podcast now. And welcome back.
Yes. Also, we have a guest that we're going to be interviewing later in this episode, Dennis Detweller, IP developer, Play First, partner in Arc Dream Publishing, art director for The Unspeakable Oath, and author of the upcoming Cthulhu Mythos novel, Delta Green, Through a Glass Darkly.
Mm-hmm. So. And General Swell Guy.
Yep.
So also a gun nut, but I attribute that to almost any American that I've met, being a Canadian myself. He knows a lot about guns.
Well, again, he's American, so, you know.
Yeah.
We all know about guns. It's
it's illegal to not own one.
It's true.
Well, it's funny because when people come to America and they want to become citizens, they learn things like the Pledge of Allegiance and the preamble to the Constitution and whatever they're required to learn. I don't know because I've never had to. But people who are born here just learn about guns.
Yes,
you have to learn about the different caliber ratings and all that kind of stuff.
Yep. Yep. And gauges, and how to know the difference between a caliber and a gauge.
Exactly.
And, I had to correct that in a newspaper article not long ago. And it was by our sports guys, too. So the guys who know hunting and ought to know better.
Yeah,
They dared refer to a particular kind of shotgun that's,
Is it 10 caliber or something?
No, it wasn't that bad. I don't remember what it was now, but it was some kind of funky thing that I had to double check. And I said, no, you said that wrong.
I got
that is shameful.
Yeah.
Small gun anecdote. Several years ago, I visited my brother who's teaching English in Japan, and I visited his classroom. This was like a middle school, and so I talked a little bit in English so they could get a sense, of what an American sounds like, speaking in English. So I talked to about my experiences, what I did in America, and then at one point I drew a stick figure holding a beer can and a gun in my best stick figure, and I said, "This is the typical American. We are all like that." And they all nodded, like they weren't sure if I was telling a joke or not. But they my brother thought it was funny. But yeah, so at least there's one school of Japanese middle school students that thinks, you know, that all Americans carry around beers and guns all the time. So I did my part to bring American culture to the rest of the world.
And they tell you that the Japanese word for gun is ju.
Really?
I don't know. Did they? Because that's.
I didn't ask. I didn't.
Think. These are important things to know.
Typical American. You don't even ask what other people think.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway,
should we do some Unspeakable Oath sponsor shout outs?
I would love to, because I like
them. Is it
them.
That time?
Yeah. So here's what I'm going to do. We've got. Since we last recorded Unspeakable about a year and a half ago, we've had we have two new issues out since then. Our first issue, new issue, was 18, and which was the December issue, and that means, of course, that it came out in like January or February. And then issue 19 is the March issue, which came out in April, and then it took till like early July for it to actually get to everybody. And then issue 20, because I'm trying to get us less late, is the the June issue, and it's I've just placed the print order for it, so it'll be shipping to everybody very, very shortly. So we'll have a lot of people that like took forever to get issue 19 because of let's call them logistical delays. That'll be getting 19 and then 20 like 2 weeks later rather than 3 months later. So you know, enjoy that. Let's see. Our sponsors I'm gonna run down. Atlas Games is back. They supported 18. They supported 19. They're supporting 20. And therefore, I encourage everybody to go pay them a visit because they're awesome people. So their new thing is they've got two things. The Antarctic Express is Ken Height's retelling of At the Mountains of Madness for little kids. And then Cthulhu Gloom is a Lovecraftian expansion to the Gloom card game, which I've played lots of times, and it's super,
yeah, that's
super
really
fun.
Yeah,
it's neat. It like the cards are like these plastic transparent cards with art on them that you sort of overlay the cards on top of each other to stack up effects and points and things like that. And the usual Gloom game is sort of it's very Edward Gorey. It's very,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Kind of, yeah, Victorian, you know, dark humor. So Cthulhu Gloom is that plus tentacle monsters. So it's going to be super fun. And let's see, Innsmouth Free Press is on board with issues 19 and 20. They're promoting historical Lovecraft tales of horror through time with 26 Cthulhu mythos stories spanning the ages at InsmouthFreePress.com. And yeah, I don't have detailed things to say about historical Lovecraft because I don't have a copy of it. But it's Cthulhu Mythos stories by good writers, and by all means, go check it out at InsmouthFreePress.com. And Miskatonic River Press is another sponsor that's been with us through 18, 19, and 20. They've got Call of Cthulhu campaigns such as New Tales of the Miskatonic Valley, More Adventures in Arkham County, and Our Ladies of Sorrow. So Miskatonic River Press, they kind of specialize in, you know, very classic, sort of old school Call of Cthulhu adventures. And we have a lot of writers and creative types in common with them. They're at MiskatonicRiverPress.com. And finally, for Oath 20, the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival, September 16th and 17th in Los Angeles, is on board. So you can go to that and see the Whisper in Darkness movie that I'm desperate to see, but it's going to be ages before I get to because I'm in deepest, darkest Alabama, where nothing shiny and glittering ever happens. But you can see it there, and Guillermo del Toro is there, so you can talk to him about his Mountains of Madness movie that he wants to do, and try to make him confirm or deny what he said in that magazine article, that he wanted to have the Shoggoths dissolve in saltwater like slugs. And they're at hplfilmfestival.com.
Yeah, an interesting thing I can say about H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival is that I believe last year was the last year that they had it in Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. It was run by Andrew Migliori, a good friend of mine. He had done that, oh gosh, I'm going to say for 15 years. I think almost as long as I've been in the band, The Darkest of the Hillside Thickets. So
yeah,
close to 20 years, I think. And he had decided that last year was going to be the last one that he was going to take care of. So Aaron Vanek, a filmmaker from Los Angeles, who's done The Yellow Sign and Return to Innsmouth and a bunch of other short films, he is basically taking over the reins and he's taking it down to California. And he's a great guy, and I encourage everyone to support both of them and check out the film festival. I've been down there many times, not only as a guest, but as a watcher of fine video films.
Yeah, last year, Scott Glancy, that works with us all the time, was doing readings there, and John Scott Tynes is there all the time. And their website says that they'll have a Portland festival in May 2012.
Oh, well, there you go. Just in time for the end of the world.
Yeah, yeah, that's perfect.
Forward to that.
Well, I thought it was December 2012, not 2012.
I'm looking at their, they have a blog post from...
Oh, the end of the world is in December, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So. Oh, okay. So there,
there'll be a little wiggle room.
Yeah.
You can enjoy what you see at the Hollywood Theater in Portland, right, and then as you digest it.
World and if by any chance the Mayans were wrong in their calculations and it ends early, then...
Yeah. You know, you'll have gotten, well, at least you've seen the Whisper in the Darkness, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk about Unspeakable Oath stuff. Can we do that?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It must be time to for some unspeakable news.
Yeah. So we've already told you about the Ennie Awards. So I'll skip that bullet point. And if you don't remember what we said, rewind your iPod a little bit and listen to that all over again. Vote for the Oath.
And, or your generic MP3 player if you don't have an iPod.
Right. I can't imagine that kind of horror, but if that's your fate, then do that. Okay, so Oath 19 out in PDF and in print, and I think by now everybody who should have it has it, and that's guaranteed to get me an angry email saying that I'm wrong, but... and if that's the case, then send me that angry email and we'll try to sort it out. But Oath 19 is out, and Oath 20 is out in PDF right now and starts shipping in print this week. I placed the big giant print order just today after reviewing proofs, and so it's heading to our warehouses this week, and that means that it ought to be out and in the hands of people in the U.S. and on the way to people everywhere else by the time we get to Gen Con with it. So we'll be working on Oath 20 shortly. I actually need to send some stuff into playtesting for that. I've got a couple of really cool adventures that we've gotten and some other stuff in line that we're looking at for that. I had a note for myself to talk about what's in those issues, but I'm trying to dig through my giant pile of disorganized crap on my desk to find a copy so I can tell you. But, what did we do? It's the usual kind of stuff. Basically, every episode of The Oath, we have Tales of Terror, which are sort of short adventure seeds that you can turn into a night of scariness. And arcane artifacts, which are basically things you can throw into your game that are fully described and have history and so forth. And mysterious manuscripts that are sort of new Cthulhu mythos tomes or sources of information. So actually in 19, we have two manuscripts that are actually books, and then one of them is the horrible basement of this evil person that imprisons people down there, and then as they go insane, they sort of scribble crap all over it, and that turns into nasty, horrible truths. Mm-hmm. And then big feature articles and then scenarios. So for 19, we had an article by Greg Stolze called Bernice Cartfield, which is about this. It's a Delta Green character. It's sort of a sort of sorceress who is trying to stay out of the way of the kinds of sorcerers that usually populate Cthulhu mythos stories. You know, the ones that want to sacrifice kittens and, you know, end the world and conjure Yog-Sothoth and all that stuff. You know, she does magic, but she mainly just wants to sort of make her way through life and not get sacrificed to anything.
That's a noble goal.
Yeah. So in 19 we had another thing called the Paramour of Yggolnach, which is basically a new Cthulhu monster that you can use to flesh out your Yggolnach encounters, so to speak. And Cheating Madness was the other big feature in 19, which is sort of an article on with ideas on how to keep characters in the mix even after they've gone totally crazy.
Well, I'm also looking through Unspeakable Oath 20 right now, and a few things have already popped out of my popped out at me. One is a very lengthy article on the assassins,
the historical
order of assassins,
Muslim cult, right?
And Mythos' take on that looks very interesting. And then something I've actually read before, which was Let's Learn Aklo, a close timeline carbo for Delta Green, which is the winner of the 2010 Shotgun Scenario Contest on the Delta Green email list. Mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting, very unique scenario that is quite a puzzler. You know, if you like movies like Primer, Time Crimes, or you will like this. I will say it's very much which came's first, the chicken or the Shoggoth?
Right.
And it looks like a really good write up. They've really
the way the shotgun scenarios work on the Delta Green mailing list is basically, you know, the idea is that you just are supposed to write a really short, punchy, self-contained adventure, and then you can kind of flesh that out with character stats and write-ups and stuff, but the main meat of the adventure ought to be very, very short and to the point. And so what we did this time around I encouraged voting online by the mailing list members on what were their favorite ones that people came up with. And then I took the top three of those and put those in front of Oath playtesters. And then the one that got the best response, I collated all the playtest notes and talked to the author he sort of tightened it up and added on to it based on those notes to turn it into a real live playtested thing. So that's how that happened, and it was kind of a fun process, and it came together pretty nicely. So yeah, in the Oath we actually have two for 20. We have two kind of timey time gone weird sort of adventures, that one and then She Just Couldn't Stay Away, which is about it's basically about a crazy old cat lady. And then things get even crazier based on from stuff she gets involved with. So they're both really kind of interesting and cool. And we didn't set out to have a kind of time travel-y theme, but by gum, we got one.
In Star Trek, they call them temporal anomalies.
Yes, it's a temporal.
They call them the mid-season episodes that they don't have much of a budget for. So yeah. All right. Let's just.
We don't need CGI. It takes place in Los Angeles in the 20th
century. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's an unused film set from the 19th century. Let's use that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're filming a Western next door. Let's take advantage.
Right. <Yeah. laughs> So for also adventures, other adventures in 19, our adventures were the Brick Kiln, which is a Trail of Cthulhu mystery set in rural England, and Suited and Booted, which is a Call of Cthulhu adventure set in London, England, in the 20s. And it's got all kinds of street gangs and a degenerate drug-addled artist who's causing problems, as artists usually do.
Hey.
Present company excluded.
Should we talk about Delta Green Through a Glass Darkly?
Oh, you betcha. Big novel for Delta Green, we'll talk about this more when we have Dennis on in a little
bit. The actual author, yes.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, basically, it was a when Delta Green first came out in the 90s, in the late 90s, the guys,
it was a very good year.
The guys put together a couple of fiction anthologies, and John Tynes, now John Scott Tynes, wrote a novel that was sort of a spinoff from one of the short stories that he'd done, and that kind of had dealt extensively with the leadership of Delta Green and some of the ramifications of the things that it gets involved with. And so that was 1999, and then, you know, it's many years later now, but Dennis, about 5 years ago, started working on a sort of sequel to that. And originally there were going to be two sequels, one by Adam Scott Glancy, who was one of the three co-creators of Delta Green with John and Dennis, and then the next one by Dennis, and they were going to have this whole sort of trilogy thing with the three authors. And you know, basically Scott's book just sort of got derailed, and Dennis decided to just knuckle down and finish his. So the action in Through the Glass Darkly actually picks up like after some major events that happened in Scott's story. And then it kind of, you know, it accelerates things pretty heavily, or brings a lot of things to a conclusion that were part of the kind of core story in Delta Green in the 90s. And that's going to sort of lay the groundwork for a lot of what we're working on right now on bringing that setting forward some and exploring what it's going to look like in the 2010s.
And that's coming out in August, the ebook edition?
Yeah, the Through Glass Darkly is going to be out next month in ebook, and then in September we're going to be shipping out the hardback for the Kickstarter patrons. They'll get and well, it'll be on sale as well, but the Kickstarter people get it first. And so yeah, it'll be a very nice kind of hardback with a dust jacket and everything, just like a real book. And and then we'll have it available in paperback eventually as well. So yeah, it's very cool, and it's been really exciting seeing it come together.
Cool. What's happening at Gen Con?
Oh, what's not happening at Gen Con, Torin? So as we're recording this, Gen Con is in 2 weeks or something like that, maybe three,
yeah.
Two and a half. I don't know.
Two and a half, yeah.
Yeah, not many. And so by the time people are listening to this, that'll be down to like, you know, even less. So if you happen to be going to Gen Con, then we're going to be doing all kinds of games and panels. We've got about 24 registered games for Delta Green and Wild Talents and Godlike and Monsters that are all already sold out. And because of Gen Con's funky new pre-reservation, you know, system, they all basically were sold out the instant that they went, that registration went online. But Gen Con being Gen Con, a lot of times people don't show up to filled up games, to sold out games. So get some generic tickets if you wanted to get in on those games, and go to them and see if they actually have a full house or not. Because if somebody has flaked out and not shown up when the game starts, then hand your generic ticket to the GM and jump in the game. You can have a good time. So I think, Ross, you're running some of those games, right?
Yes, I am running several games of Road Trip, obviously. Actually, I set them up before I knew I was going to get in any, but, you know, happy coincidence.
Yeah.
And then I'm also going to be running a Wild Talents one-shot that I've already play-tested. I've put the results, three playtests, and I've put each one, four playtests, but three of them put online because one of them got deleted. Wild Talents... Caped Cannibals and Other, Zombies and Other Caped Cannibals. It's a Marvel zombie kind of Wild Talents game where there's, you know, superhero infected superheroes who become super zombies, and each person is a normal person who's gotten one superpower, and how can they survive a city full of normal zombies and super zombies? And every time I've run it, you know, with the same scenario, it winds up radically different. You know, different groups. Sometimes the city gets saved. Sometimes it gets nuked. Sometimes the heroes make it. Sometimes they don't. It's always very entertaining because it's very much kind of a sandbox scenario. So it's up to who gets what type of character. It's been very entertaining. So I'll be running those. I'm also doing a seminar called 1001 Uses for Zombies and Role-Playing Games. It is going to be me talking about different ways. Zombies are more than just a simple enemy to kill, you know, a low-level enemy. They're a building block for dramatic and exciting conflicts in role-playing games. So if you want to think of new ways to use zombies, you can talk about it, because I am going to doing this in celebration of my book, Zombies of the World, which is a field guide to zombies and the undead. So I'll have copies there for sale too at the Arc Dream booth. So if you wanted to see what the book looked like, if you wanted to see, ask me questions about, you know, how to use zombies, that sort of thing, that would be a thing to check out. The seminar is free, by the way, and you don't need tickets for that. So I'm just gonna fill out the room if I can.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll have handouts too. So yeah.
Do you remember when your seminar is?
It is on a day in Gen Con, and I will look that up right now.
Okay, look that up and tell us, because the other one we're doing is Delta Green and the Unspeakable Oath, where we'll talk all about both Delta Green and the Unspeakable Oath with me and Scott Glancy and Monty Cook and Greg Stolze and Kenneth Height. However, it's come to my attention that because I'm an idiot, I put that on the same night as the Ennie Awards, so so I actually expect Ken Height will be at the Ennie Awards, because he usually wins one, and rather than on the panel with the rest of us schlubs. So in that case, if you know, if the Oath does win one, go vote for the Oath at the Ennie Awards. You know, then I'll see if I can get Ken or Ross or somebody to say some kind words on our behalf.
Yeah, my panel, my seminar is Saturday noon to 1:30 p.m. And then let's see here, all the other Delta Green.
Yeah,
Delta Green and the Unspeakable Oath is Thursday 8 to 10 p.m. So this will be.
Our seminar is Thursday?
It says Thursday, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. on the...
Okay. Well, I advise everybody to just look that up, because I may be stupid and not even remembering properly. Now that I've tried to correct myself, I may be doing it wrong. So, but we'll have panels.
Yeah.
And at some point in Gen Con, and they'll be fun. So come to them.
And you'll have all three of the new issues of the Unspeakable Oath in your hands.
Yes, we will.
And, get them autographed. And get Zombies of the World autographed. Get Road Trip autographed. Get everything autographed. Yeah. So
we'll sign stuff like crazy.
We'll sign stuff that I haven't even written. You know.
Yeah. Autographing stuff is really interesting at Gen Con. I think for the first time last year. I may have done it some in past years, but last year we had the new Delta Green book. So with, you know, Greg and Scott and me and Ken all around, but mainly Greg and Scott and me were all in the same booth most of the time. So we would all the time have people coming up with the Delta Green with targets saying, sign it. So we would just sort of grab it and then pass it over to the next person. And after a while, you kind of get desperate to figure out something interesting to write, you know, that you haven't written 50 times before. It's pretty wild. But we're all generous, like good famous people when it comes to signing autographs. So come enjoy that.
Will you commit yourselves to signing a breast if someone asks?
We'll line all three of us up next to each other and sign. You mean actually writing on a on. Sure. Why not?
Like real rock stars.
As long as nobody takes a picture to show my wife.
That's I mean, you don't write tabletop RPGs for the money. You write it for, you know, the fame and the groupies. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just, you know, science. That's just fact. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Winning an any award would be great, but either way, nobody mess with my cocaine.
Do you guys want to talk about the Kerberos Club?
Yeah. What we're doing with that is so the Kerberos Club was a Victorian era Wild Talents book, and Wild Talents is a superhero role-playing game that ArcDream did, and so basically what happened was all of the people that were responsible for the Oath back in the day got together and helped Dennis Detweiler and Greg Stolze do a superhero game called Godlike, which is set in World War II, and then Wild Talents was our sort of spin-off from that, or sequel to it, and then the Kerberos Club is a Victorian era setting for that rules set, and it was nominated for any awards itself back in the day, and so we're doing a new edition of that using the Fate rules engine, which is all hip and hot these days, and I may have copies of that book at Gen Con. We're sort of in the last stages of finishing the layout now. So even though we're only days away from the convention, we may be able to rush it out the door and have some copies to show off at the show. So if we do, that'll be extra exciting.
Cool.
It will be.
What about the Zombies of the World business?
Yeah. Tell us more about that, Ross. You said that was, I haven't seen the book proper because I've been too lazy to actually order it, but I've seen like some teasers for it, and it looks very fun. It's got real full color art and really nice full color art too.
Yeah, I was very lucky to get some very talented artists to work on it. And it's this is not an Arc Dream book per se. I'm self publishing, and I actually printed actual books of it. And it's a fictional field guide to 20 different species of zombies. I'm taking a different approach than the standard zombie pseudo survival guides that there's a whole bookshelf of them out there, different. Not just the zombie survival guide, but the zombie combat manual and just all these different other things. They all take the same approach of being a survivalist kind of approach to it, how to kill them, how to survive, blah, 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 blah. So I took a different approach. I took it as like a naturalist approach, like a scientific field guide, like, an Ottoman field guide to zombies. So I came up with scientific names for different species and gave them descriptions and their ranges and habitats. And so I tried to do it with all the major zombie species, including, I thought of, a mummy really is a desert zombie. If you think about it, they're slow, they're
correct,
undead,
yes.
They kill people. So I also took, the ghouls from Lovecraft as, New England ghouls and artificial zombies, and then revenants and dancing zombies too, because, that's a big, archetype in zombies now are dancing zombies. Choreographicus is their scientific name. And
now in Spaceship Zero, we have atomic zombies. And later in Fallout 3, you've got your radioactive zombies. Yeah. They call it ghouls. How does that square in?
Well, I do have artificial zombies. I was going with more of the reanimator approach. I don't have atomic zombies in there, but these are just the 20 most popular species.
Okay, sure.
So I was thinking more not zombies that would appear in I guess in the real world, or the Living Dead movies, Return of the Living Dead, also folk tales, and fiction. So Dragoors from Viking and or Norse mythology, and Praetas from Asian mythology, and hopping corpses from China. And then so aside from describing them, I also talk about their history with humanity, how they migrate to stay close to humanity, how humanity's evolved around them, how adapted to them. And also scientific research into zombies. Like, how would people – like, the thing about zombies is that they never get tired or stop. I mean, they don't – even if – when they eat somebody, they don't digest the food. So how can they keep going forever? So I came up with a scientific term – called the Omega Anima, which is kind of like dark matter in the sense that it's a term for something science doesn't yet understand. I mean, right. it's something that they speculate it has to be there because nothing else makes sense. And right now, my idea is if there were zombies, that people would be researching them and trying to figure out how to use them for our own benefit. So, like zombies, they're really clean. I mean, they're environmentally friendly. They just rot. So if we can get them on stationary bicycles, they could generate electricity for us.
A dangling brain instead of a carrot.
Exactly. So that's like the state of the research is trying to get how to motivate zombies to pedal on stationary bicycles for eternity. So Zombies of the World is just a broad spectrum of talking about how zombies would be, how they would actually be if they were in the real world, because I don't think they would just instantly destroy civilization or take over. I think, you know, they're zombies. Even a few normal people with decent, you know, firearm skill could wipe out hordes of them. And people, of course, I do talk about zombie survival tips in it, like zombies, the most dangerous thing in a zombie attack aren't the actual zombies, it's the other people. You know, you have criminals, religious fanatics, crazy people. I mean, you watch zombie movies and everything, it's other people that get, you know, the main characters killed. It's not the zombies themselves usually. You know, the zombies are just kind of there. Mm-hmm. And if it weren't for that, you know, that jerk who caused all the problems, you know, and opened the door or selfishly took all the guns, then, you know, everything would be okay. So, that's what you have to be worried about in a zombie event. So I made some posters up saying, beware of zombies, beware of humans, you know, the different types of people you have to be aware of. So that's what it is. It's about, it's not a gaming book per se, because I don't have any role-playing game stats in it, but it's certainly very gameable if you want to create a zombie game, because it'll give you, if you read through it, you'll find a lot of different ideas in it.
Awesome.
That's my pitch for it.
All right. Well, awesome. And that's zombiesoftheworld.com is your thing?
Yes. Right. And it's already gotten two reviews so far from zombiezonenews.com and LibraryNot. Mm-hmm. And I will put links to them there on the show notes here so you can read what other people have said. It's already gotten a couple good reviews on Amazon, too. I've put it on Amazon. There's a Kindle version that you can get off of Amazon. There's also a PDF version you can just buy directly through my store. So if you don't want to get the book is actually really high quality, glossy paper, full color. So
awesome.
It looks well illustrated.
Yes, it is. I had some really good artists. I really need to talk about them. Put some blog posts up about them. Tom Rhodes, Ian Moody. Ian Moody did some of the art for Road Trip and for the RPPR podcast. So, yeah.
Cool. Well, Sean, what's up with you lately?
Ooh, little old me?
little and old and you.
Oh, well, gosh. I believe I talked about this last episode, the new video for the Darkest of the Hillside Thicket song, 20 Minutes of Oxygen, will be showing at the Holly Shorts Film Festival. If you are around Hollywood at the Arclight Theater, not sure what the address of that is, but Google can help you with that. Monday, August 15th, it's playing in a video block between 7:30 and 9:30. That's the most recent information I have. So if you want to see me and my bandmates dying horribly in space, then you can do that.
Mm-hmm. And that's Arclight, Arc with a C?
Yes, that's right.
Like the
the way you'd like it spelled.
Like the bombing runs in Vietnam.
Yes, not like the Ark of the Covenant.
Right. Okay, well, awesome. Cool. And you guys are still doing new, you're making new music, right?
We most recently wrote a song about the 1919 Boston molasses disaster, so that's going to be a good time.
I didn't know there was a molasses disaster.
So many people are doing those these days. I mean, I'm sorry, you're going to have to do something very original.
Derivative.
So.
The question is, which part of the molasses disaster are you focusing on?
Primarily the death.
Okay.
The horrible, sticky, sweet death. Yeah, 21 people died in that molasses-related disaster. That was the most deadly molasses-related disaster in the history of the Americas.
Wow.
So.
Awesome.
Great. So that'll be done whenever it's done.
Yeah. Well, cool. So are you guys shooting for a particular schedule, you know, benchmarks?
Hey, like you can't rush art, my friend. I know you can.
Yeah, you can. It just turns out crappy. I know full well.
Yeah. No, well, we're just busy writing songs, and when we feel that we have a good album, then we will make recording plans, and we don't really have a set date for that.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I mean, that's not awesome, but I'm glad you're working on stuff.
Yeah, we will release No Cthulhu Rock before it's time.
Oh, cool. Okay, so what else are we doing here?
Zombies of the World 2 review? Oh, sorry, you already talked about that.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, so let's talk about Cthulhu Mythos stuff.
Let's talk about Mythos-y news.
Yes. I would like to mention just a few minor notices I've seen of Cthulhu things recently, and they aren't like totally brand new, but they're new to me, probably new to you. One is there's a new Scooby-Doo cartoon on the Cartoon Network, and they recently had an episode, or last year they had an episode where they had a character named H.P. Hatecraft, voice acted by the Jeffrey Combs. Mm-hmm. And the episode is called H.P. Hatecraft and the Shrieking Madness. And also guest starring on that was Harlan Ellison as himself.
Now, was this part of the? This was part of the actual official Scooby-Doo thing. I thought, yes. I saw this, but I thought it was just some, you know, talented people mocking something up.
No, this is they actually got Harlan Ellison. I mean, and Harlan Ellison, if you're familiar with him, he does not do anything unless he is paid for it.
Yeah.
So he, as part of Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated. Which is an actual show, and there are clips of it on YouTube. It can also be watched in full on the Cartoon Network's website. It is. There's a lot of references in there, so hopefully the next generation of kids will be also, you know, infected with the Lovecraftian meme.
I wonder if they decided to go Hatecraft because they thought it would be clever, or if they decided that Lovecraft might be too suggestive for their audience.
Oh wow, I hadn't even thought of that. I thought there was just another pun kind of joke, you know, wordplay that those cartoons are famous for. So yeah, I thought that was pretty clever. And then there's a Scottish sketch comedy show called Burniston, and in series 2, episode 6, there's a Lovecraftian sketch about a guy who has a horrible, indescribable monster from beyond time and space in his basement, and he goes to his estate agent, which is, you know, basically their realtor, sort of small town government agent, to get the monster out of his basement. And he's described, it's indescribable and horrible and ancient. I can't describe it to you. Does it have a name? No, it's unnameable.
Yeah, it's pretty good. They're basically trying to fill out a form to describe this undescribable creature, and hilarity ensues.
No, it can't be described.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's in Scottish accents, so that makes it funnier. And then there's Cthulhu Saves the World, but I figured we'd talk about that in the section of games we've been playing, because I've actually picked that up Steam. And Cthulhu Saves the World is a great game, but we'll talk about that more.
I wanted to mention, I noticed that Call of Cthulhu 30th Anniversary Collector's Edition from Chaosium, because 2011 marks the 30th anniversary of the release of Call of Cthulhu. And so they are making a 320-page book with thick leatherette hardcovers, with the front cover and spine stamped with luxurious gold foil. And the binding is thread sewn, square backed. It's a one-time printing, so that's pretty cool.
That sounds
something
fancy.
Yeah, if you really wanted to have your Necronomicon-esque Call of Cthulhu rulebook.
They ought to be. They ought to do more. Like, make it as Necronomicon-esque as possible. I want to see, like, you know, a Call of Cthulhu book that's in I don't know, octopus leather or something.
Oh, I was going to suggest get your Call of Cthulhu rulebook bound in human skin, but...
Well, yeah, you could...
Is that too far?
Well, there are plenty of Call of Cthulhu fans who have died and would probably donate their bodies to a good cause.
Yeah, Chaosium should set that up on their webpage, you know, if you want to donate your tissue to the next special edition of Call of Cthulhu.
Well, there's also, you could, you know, there's a German artist who does what he calls plastination, which is to take, you know, a corpse and, you know, cover it in this clear plastic so it's immortalized.
It's not actually covered. It's injected with plastic, and then the biological material generally kind of either absorbed or is wasted away.
So you could create, you know, the hands of Call of Cthulhu hands as sort of like a book holder, you know, holding the book up. See, that would be appropriately creepy enough. Sand losing. But wow, I might actually have to get this because I've had the same copy of Call of Cthulhu. I have a edition 5.2 that I've had since middle school, and I've just carried. I have never gotten a newer one, and it's you know getting pretty banged up at this point. I don't want to have it actually fall apart. I think I bought it used for $10, and so I've gotten more bang out of my buck than I think any game I'll ever get in my life. But
I'll certainly get it. Just you know, basically. I think more from completion than anything else, because I have all of the previous editions on the shelf.
Oh, wow.
Even though I haven't, you know, most of them I haven't looked at in 20 years.
Are they actually going to have this at Gen Con this year?
Oh, I doubt it. I don't know. I haven't heard one way or another, but I doubt it anyway.
Well, I know that I had they came out with a special edition the year that I went to Gen Con, which was strange eons ago, but I actually came back with a copy, and it was bound in a blank paper bag and covered with twine, and had the address from Miskatonic University as a return postal address. And I never actually ended up taking the twine off and unwrapping it because I was frightened.
Nice, that's pretty swell. Yeah, so that's I guess something to look for. I don't think Chaosium maintains their own booth at Gen Con at all anymore. They're repped by Adventure Retail Gaming or whatever it's called, but it's basically if you're at Gen Con, there's this or Dragon Con, they're at a lot of conventions, but it's sort of this big expansive wide retail area that has big posters up for Atlas Games and Chaosium and Steve Jackson and you know several people of that ilk, so that's probably the first place that I'll have to make a mission of that, of going and seeing if they actually have it there.
That'd nice.
Be nice. They do.
Yeah.
And then what else? Joe R. Lansdale. This just came out, so I know virtually nothing about it. But Joe R. Lansdale, horror writer, is doing a comic book adaptation of the Dunwich Horror, which will have each of the issues of that limited series will have the Hound as well adapted. So he's doing that with IDW, which is the company that did, if I remember right, they did 28 Days of Night back when it was just a comic book before they made the big movie that made millions of dollars. So they've got, you know, they've got some history in that kind of thing. And Joe R. Lansdale, of course, is a long-standing horror author from Texas who's done lots of comic book work, and he writes very, very scary kind of, you know, squishy horror, and he's a very sharp writer. I really like his writing style a lot. So it'll be kind of, I think it'll be really interesting to see his kind of take on putting the Dunwich Horror into that medium.
Nice.
You know, comics are always kind of tricky, just for the same reason that movies are and TV is for Lovecraft, because so much of Lovecraft's stories depend on his particular approach to descriptions. It's all about mood with him, and more even than actually what's happening, he's always much more interested in sort of how it feels when it's happening. So so conveying that you know in a visual medium is always kind of challenging, which is why so many of the the sort of the Lovecraft movies have succeeded, because they're so campy, and so few of them have succeeded just on their own merits as actual scary things.
Yeah, I think the best one I've seen to date that's a direct Lovecraftian movie is The Resurrected by Dan O'Bannon, and that was just a, you know, made for HBO movie that very few people are aware of. But that
I've never seen it.
Oh, really? It's based on the case of Charles Dexter Ward. Mm-hmm. And they really do a really good straight adaptation of it. It looks great, and the sections in the actual dungeon of the doctor, you know, the older ancestor, are just creepy as hell, because Dan O'Bannon knows when to use the monsters and when not to use the monsters. So
right.
It's just, you know, a few... Sorry.
And it starred Chris Sarandon as the ancestor,
Oh, okay.
And you may remember him as Prince Humperdinck in The Princess Bride.
Oh, you betcha, yeah.
Yeah, so awesome. He did a great job.
Well, that's cool. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, it's out on DVD. It's a great short little movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's on, 90 minutes, and it's just very underrated. Cool. So, or very, unknown.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of comics, Lovecraft comics, I was just recently made aware that graphically.com is kind of an online webcomic service where you can actually go to read Boom Studios' Fall of Cthulhu and Cthulhu Tales and books as well. So mm-hmm. if you don't have a comic book store near you or you can't find that special issue, you can always go to graphically.com and check it out there.
Yeah, have either of y'all followed? And that's because I live in Alabama, that's why I say that. Followed the Fall of Cthulhu comics at all?
I did. I read that. That is the set in Atlantis, or I believe where it's talking about. Boom Studio has done a lot. I've done a lot of Lovecraftian comics. They're written by Michael Allen Nelson, and they're kind of interesting takes on. The Lovecraft, the Cthulhu mythos, because he's talking about how it's how this ancient civilization falls. I think it's Hyperborea, they call it. And it's been a while since I've read it, but it's got some interesting ideas on how Nyarlathotep actually works, how he corrupts people, and how mythos sorcerers can be tricked, that sort of thing. So they're interesting. Because it's not a direct Lovecraftian pastiche. He's taking material and sort of figuring out what would happen in the areas that Lovecraft didn't directly write in. He's not just treading over the exact same territory.
Okay.
There's some sample pages on their website,
And that was graphic. What is the website you mentioned, Torin? Graphically.
It's Graphically. Yeah, Graphic. Spelled like you normally would spell it with L-Y in the end. There's no period. It's not like Bitly. It's graphically.com. And
all
you
right.
can just type in Cthulhu in the search bar and they'll all come up.
Awesome.
Assuming you know how to spell Cthulhu, I can only assume.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
All right.
Shall we... So let's go to the segment where we review things we've actually played or read. Johnny?
Yeah, let's do that. Who's up? Boss, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, let's talk about a couple of things. I've been playing a few different games. First off is I have been playing a little bit of Arkham Horror again, and this time with the Kingsport expansion, which is not the newest one, but it's the newest one we've had in the group I've been playing with. They've had the Innsmouth and now the Kingsport expansion. And it's very interesting because Arkham Horror, or because Kingsport gives the players an actual chance of winning that, like, is very unusual in Arkham Horror. In Kingsport, there's one character who has an ability. Each investigator has their own unique abilities. And one of them is the politician, Charlie Kane. And Charlie Kane has the ability to stop the terror level from increasing, which is really, really, really important. If you're familiar with Arkham Horror, there's a Doom level, Doom track, and a terror level. The terror level at higher levels of it means more monsters can come out, shops close, things get more difficult. And that also adds to the Doom track. When the Doom track fills up, the Ancient One wakes up and you have to fight him. And usually you're not going to win. Mm-hmm. So as long as you can keep terror from increasing, you're doing really well. And if you can get certain characters to work with him as sort of a combo effect, you can fulfill his personal quests and get a lot of things done very quickly. There's also Guardians, which work like Heralds. Heralds are kind of like main henchmen to the Ancient One, like Dagon or Mother Hydra, and they make things a little more difficult. Guardians increase things in your favor. There's Hypnos, Bast, and Nodens. Each one of them helps you out in slight different, in different ways. So if you want to actually have a chance of winning Arkham Horror, you might try and get Kingsport. There's some new challenges though. There's Rifts. Which are like gates but they move around. They just dump monsters all over the map, so that can be dangerous.
Yeah.
Plus, there's new heralds and ancient ones. So we beat Gahanna Thoa, which is the the great old one that turns people to stone when you look at even a representation of him. So that was a pretty epic battle. But yeah, next up, Black Bag Jobs. We talked about this in the last episode. It's the first scenario anthology for the Laundry RPG, which are based on the Charles Stross novels. And I've read them. I haven't actually run any of them yet. And they take the default campaign model, which is bureaucratic espionage, plus Lovecraftian horror investigation in the British, government. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff you have to do about paperwork and office politics and when office politics turns to demon summoning and assassinations and stuff like that. So if you're an existing fan with the series, it's great. But mm-hmm. it's my big problem with the Laundry RPG is how do I get my players to buy into it, because they haven't read any of the novels. They don't want to do anything about bureaucrats.
Yeah.
And that
when someone says, "Do you want to play this role playing game?" and they tell me that it's about filing taxes, that's what I do in real life. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they actually do a really good job of making that entertaining, but getting players to even try it, get it to that point where they realize that is going to be difficult.
Yeah, I think it will probably help if your players are already pretty well versed in British humor and in the kind of culture that the Stross novels came out of, which they're both hilarious and really, spooky and scary in turns, and I love them to death, but they're very British, and it's great if you're an Anglophile like me, but if you're, just Joe non-Britain, and you don't know very much about that kind of thing, then you've got that sort of hurdle to figure out how to, if you're the GM and you're the only one that knows what that tone is all about, then you've got to figure out how to sort of present all of that in a way that your players are going to dig.
Plus the way magic works, I mean, it's Cthulhu mythos, but it's pretty modified, so mm-hmm. actually understanding how magic works in this and through computational devices and all that other stuff takes a little, understanding to buy in. And, one of these days I'm going to write a tutorial adventure where, players start out totally ignorant of everything and I slowly introduce the concepts to them, mm-hmm. To try and see if they'll buy into it. I had to do the same thing with Eclipse Phase, because Eclipse Phase is a very, very cool game, but, again, very complex and hard to buy into if you haven't read it. Mm-hmm. it's an interesting conundrum.
That's the case with a lot of settings. A lot of settings where the setting is really important in what the players do. There are some games where it's not. I mean, if you're playing D&D, for most adventures, it doesn't really matter where the player characters are and what their role in the world is, right? But
right.
The laundry, that's what it's all about, is what, how do your characters relate with each other? And Eclipse Phase, everything is sort of tied into the technology. And
the mind-body disconnect. And
all of that stuff. You don't necessarily, I don't think you would necessarily need to know the sort of politics, but there's still a lot that you need to kind of internalize in order
knowing that if you get blown up, you can still come back because there's a backup of you. So,
mm-hmm. which always that kind of game always requires, as the GM, you've got to. I mean, that may be worth talking about in more depth later. But as the GM, you've got to basically think ahead of how am I going to kind of introduce these themes, these ideas to the players in play in a way that's fun and isn't just me giving a lecture.
Right. I mean, I kind of have the same problem, at least from the other point of view, as being a player from the Dresden Files RPG, because I haven't read any of those novels, and some of my friends have talked about that, but, mm-hmm. if I were to play in that, I'm just kind of, all right. I mean, I'm waiting for them to try and run one, so yeah. I don't know what, but I imagine the same thing, because I understand the magic in there works kind of differently than...
Oh, okay. Well, the magic, that one is, I mean, you'll probably be fine there.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, I mean, the Dresden setting is basically...
It seems like the World of Darkness.
It's modern day fantasy stuff. I mean, there's vampires, yeah. There's werewolves, there's fairies, right. There's wizards. You know, it's nothing... None of the stuff is, like, totally out of left field, you know? So it's not that... It actually has a pretty low hurdle you need to jump to get up to speed on what's going on. And you can always just play... You know, you can play the guy that doesn't know much about the supernatural. And, you know, and you'll be fine.
Yeah. That's the Black Bag Jobs. I'd recommend it. It's got some great stuff. Mm-hmm. You could mine for Call of Cthulhu. You could certainly adapt this stuff for Call of Cthulhu. Yeah. There's one scenario that involves Facebook and makes it a vessel for ancient horror. So mm-hmm. if you hate Facebook, hey, there you go. social networking, you know.
I need to have a sequel to that one now with Google Pentagrams.
Yeah, exactly. Google Evil. Next up I have been playing Killing Floor, which I put a lot of hours into. It's a co-op first-person shooter, a little like Left 4 Dead 2, Left 4 Dead. It's very Delta Green-esque because it's more, from a military point of view, it's a team of up to six people who go into this area and try and exterminate all of these genetically engineered, you know, monstrosities. And the characters themselves, the character models, I mean, there's no plot other than that, really, but the character models are very, you know, misfit-ish. You know, there's everything from normal soldiers to, you know, welders to British street thugs. And it's another British game, actually. So mm-hmm. Right now there's going until, I think, for the end of the month, there's an event going on called the Circus, a summer event where all the monsters have been remodeled to make them look more like circus freaks. So there's a bearded lady, monkeys with chainsaws, you know, clowns that puke acid and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it's very, it's a very addicting game. And certainly you could easily take a lot of those monsters and remodel them for a Delta Green game. And it was on sale recently, the Steam summer sale. But even now it's only $20, and it's for me, I've gotten burned out on Left 4 Dead. So, this has a lot more depth to it because you have to learn more tactics and strategies to understand it. So, mm-hmm. And it plays on Max too, and much lower system requirements. So,
nice.
Yeah. And then finally, Cthulhu Saves the World, Super Nintendo / Final Fantasy inspired, you know, in terms of game mechanics, humorous take on the Cthulhu mythos. The basic backstory is that Cthulhu is Cthulhu, but a priest casts this powerful curse, puts it on Cthulhu, saying that he loses access to almost all of his power, and he can only regain the power if he becomes a true hero. So he can't destroy the world until he saves the world. And so he says, well, screw this. I'm going to become a true hero. And so he gathers up a band of unlikely misfits to help him become a true hero. And I just got the game recently, so I haven't beaten it yet. But it plays very fast. It's got, you know, the same sort of fight, magic, item kind of, you know, pick the monster you want to fight sort of. Structure to it, but it also breaks the fourth wall a lot. At one point when you're in a dungeon, you know, it's got the same top-down perspective, so when you're in a dungeon you see a giant door, it's like, oh, well, there's a giant door over there, we'll have to find a switch to open it up. Oh, really? You can, and with the other party member says, oh, you can see that? You know, like, because it's through a solid wall, you shouldn't be able to see that. And there's one of the bosses that I just beat was actually Nyarlathotep in the city of Dunwich. He turned all the people into zombies, and for some reason, and so now, you know, Cthulhu proves that he's a hero. He saved the city of Dunwich, and all the people are still zombies, but now they're happy. You know, and it's only like $3 on Steam, so. And you can also get it on the Xbox 360 in the arcade indie section. The PC version has commentary from the developer. He talks about various things. There's also bonus modes into it. And it's very playable for, you know, $3 purchase. It's certainly pretty fun. So, yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Let's see. Torrin, have you been playing anything besides music?
Did we talk about Fallout 3 in the last episode?
No, you talked about that miniatures game you were playing.
Right, Strange Eons.
Yeah.
Well, let me start out with Fallout 3 then, because if I didn't mention it last time, I definitely have to mention it now.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably my most favoritist video game in all of time and history.
All
right. It's Fallout 3, and I don't know if you guys have played it at all, but on the map, it all happens in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in the bottom left-hand of the map is the Dunwich Building.
Oh, fun.
And it is probably the creepiest and scariest part of the entire game. So kudos to the developers for that. And there's an expansion called Point Lookout, which takes place basically in this marshy area. And there's hillbillies, and it very much reminds me of the Dog Will Hunt scenario from Unspeakable Oath number 18, I think it was.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so there's there's radioactive ghouls, there's hillbillies, there's ancient tomes, and it's great fun. I cannot recommend it highly enough if you enjoy those kinds of shooting games.
Have you actually played New Vegas?
I did play New Vegas. Certainly not as there's no Lovecraftian references in it that I found. I also don't find it as enjoyable as Fallout 3 because it happens in a desert, and you know, to me, playing post-apocalyptic games is all about playing in a wasteland, and a desert is already a wasteland, so there's nothing new. Not as many ruins to find and scramble.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be harder to get a sense of what's been corrupted and destroyed.
Yeah,
right. You've lost because what was there anyway, besides Las Vegas, and you know, that's already corrupted and destroyed.
But yeah, I played it all the way through, so I guess that says something. But yeah. I didn't enjoy it.
Are you playing it on the console or on the computer?
On the Xbox, yeah.
Yeah, I've got them, but I wanted to get the PC version, actually. There are user mods available for it as well, and I think there are some that add, new radio stations and new difficulties, and there's some that are adding some kind of... There's a lot in terms of additional content. I'm sure people are... I haven't perused it, but I would not be surprised if there's some Lovecraftian content out there. But I think, you know, actually the whole premise of Fallout is there are some inherently Lovecraftian themes of, you know, the idea of a post-apocalyptic world that has been wiped out by science and people resorting to madness and different ideologies in order to get by. It makes me think of, you know, what the distant future will look like when men are no longer men. You know, when Cthulhu arises, everyone is maddened with a... certainly the characters in Fallout are pretty mentally unstable usually. The creatures, the mutant creatures, especially the centaurs, remind me a little bit of the Shoggoths. I've always considered them in the same, close to each other in the same kind of genre-wise, but that's just me, so...
And then I have also, last time I talked about Strange Eons, the miniature, the Lovecrafty miniature skirmish game. And I've been, me and my friends have started up an actual campaign, so we played a little bit more. And I just wanted to mention, for those who play Strange Eons, it's a tabletop skirmish game with miniatures, and there's a lot of rules for the terrain, but terrain is kind of expensive. So if you don't want to just play with like Lego blocks and all that kind of stuff, I would actually suggest picking up one of the flip mats from Paizo.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, they have like a graveyard and a swamp and an old town, and I think they really work well. And they're 10 to 12 bucks a pop, and then you can use it for your Strange Eons game, you can use it for Dungeons and Dragons, you can probably use it for, you know, any Call of Cthulhu game. So I think I just wanted to kind of plug those, as I've been getting a lot of mileage out of them.
Yeah, we use those really frequently in our games, in a lot of different kinds of games. I mean, I've used them in D&D games as well as RuneQuest and Aces and Eights and lots of things. They're very nice, and you know, it's the same. You know, you're looking at the same images every time you put one down, you know, but you can turn it around and get a different perspective on it than everybody's used to, and it's not that hard. It doesn't stretch credulity that much to just say, okay, everybody ignore that tree. It's not here this time.
Right, right. Well, you know what I do sometimes if I need to make a big, you know, battle map or something like that for a particular scenario, like, for example, the Wild Talents game I ran, you know, the big battle between, you know, nearly 2 dozen fighters. I took some Legos and use those to construct little miniature terrain elements for those. I don't use those all the time, but just having a couple of them or Jenga blocks, because I've played Dread, you know, that those are very useful to just generic little blocks or something like that are very useful for terrain.
Yeah.
And combine that with a battle with the mat, and that, just put a block over the tree. You know, oh, now it's a broken car that you can use for cover or whatever. So,
yeah. All right. Well, I've got two things. I mean, I'm editing the Oath, so I'm reading Mythos stuff all the time, but a lot of it is just sort of people's submissions for the magazine. So, but other stuff I've been in. Involved in. I just wrapped up a week or two ago running A New Age, which is one of the original Delta Green adventures and the first Delta Green book in the late 90s that was chock full of Torin Atkinson art. It was very exciting. And so, yeah, that was really fun. It, basically, I was running it for a group that a couple of the players had played a Delta Green game before, but it was like a one shot that I ran months ago, so none of them had played it extensively, and most of them hadn't played Call of Cthulhu extensively either, so it was kind of starting from scratch in a lot of ways. So but what I wanted to do was with the New Age it's you know, it's that's basically the last biggest adventure of the three in the main Delta Green book.
Yeah.
And it sort of starts off saying, you know, to advising you to play that as sort of the finale, you know, of an initial storyline. And I totally did the opposite. That what I wanted to do was basically make that our introduction. Because I wanted to sort of explore some elements of the setting of the sort of modern day, present day Delta Green setting that we could kind of explore using that scenario as the starting point and using the players' interaction with government, you know, the government infrastructure as a starting point. Because where most Delta Green games, they sort of assume that the players are going to be kind of undercover, you know, and they're not going to make a big deal of being FBI agents, and they're going to try to keep the authorities at arm's length. A New Age very explicitly is written, you know, starting off saying that they're brought into the middle of this big FBI investigation, and there's the crazy supernatural shit right in front of everybody, you know. I set it in the present day and kind of got to toy with some of those ideas, and then I was using basically an alternate, somewhat changed alternate rules set that's based on BRP and on the Call of Cthulhu rules, but has a few new, you know, had a few new elements in it as well. So
where'd you get these rules? Did you write them yourself, or did
it's stuff I've been working on.
Oh, cool.
Myself. So
I know the Laundry RPG, for example, is based on BRP, but they've added some new updates to the base rule, so it plays a little differently than Call of Cthulhu. So
yeah,
from whatever
they didn't.
So I wonder if it was those, but
they didn't change much. I mean, the magic items and the sort of technology, you know, the you know, spells that come.
Well, character generation too, but
the way you get skills is a little different. Yeah,
but
the stuff that I was monkeying with actually departs a little more starkly from that. You know,
my goal
with it is to have rules that where, you know, you could use a stat block from any of the old Delta Green books without a problem, and vice versa, that you could sort of where the characters and then the stats be kind of interchangeable, but at the same time, it's the character generation is tweaked and is a good bit different, and then the way that, you know, the way that it kind of, the basic mechanic is the same, but the way that it approaches, that I wanted to approach how you go about calling on skill rolls and processing them and getting the results out of them, I wanted to explore ways to kind of get more mileage out of that than just pass or fail, you know, or
crit, yeah, crit, yeah. Crit, you know. That's true. Call of Cthulhu has got a great system, but there are a couple weaknesses in there. I mean, it plays a lot better than any other system from that era, I think.
Yeah, well, Call of Cthulhu, I love. I mean, I've always loved the game, but you get the most mileage out of that game engine if you've played it an awful lot. If you've played it enough that you kind of know where the quirks are and how to either avoid them or ignore them or use them to your benefit. It can be really hard on new players in a lot of cases.
Really? As long as there's somebody to teach them there, I found it's a lot easier.
That's what I mean it's really hard on new game masters, I've found.
Because we'll
talk about this later too, but just because of the way that skills work and the kind of default of make a skill roll to proceed or to decide anything, it just doesn't do enough to tell you kind of when to do that and when to not do that and when to just sort of move things along, which is one of the reasons that Trail of Cthulhu has been so valuable, because it takes a very, very different approach, and in part explicitly out of response to Call of Cthulhu's skill-based thing, where it's too tempting as the GM to just sort of, if you haven't figured out whether you want something to happen or not happen, it's too tempting to, rather than decide on that, to just say roll dice, and then before you know it, everybody's failed that skill roll, and then you have to that it turns out it was really important for the storyline for somebody to do it. So that was what I did with the New Age, and it was a lot of fun. I put up very, very detailed actual play reports on RPG.net in their actual play forums under my username is ArcDream there.
So. Oh, yeah, I need to catch up on that. I haven't finished that. I started that. I just haven't finished it. It started out very well.
It was fun. I basically my only regret is I went a little too easy on them.
I will say I ran it too, actually. I'm very familiar with the New Age. I ran it for my group years ago. And I don't want to spoil anything for people who haven't read the actual plays or the reports or anything or the actual scenario. But I will say it ended up went kind of bad for the players, because zero sanity player with a dragon's breath around, or a zero sanity player fighting a player who had a shotgun with dragon's breath rounds and then rolled a critical fumble with the dragon's breath rounds.
Oh,
so,
nice.
Things had a rather explosive result.
Yeah.
So, good time was had by all.
So the other thing I've been doing is Graham Walmsley, who's written several Trail of Cthulhu adventures, he recently held an Indiegogo.com fundraiser for a book called Stealing Cthulhu, which is basically a book of advice on kind of co-opting Lovecraft's own story ideas and elements for your own game, and kind of tweaking them and turning them around so that they look new, but using things that that are proven to be scary and interesting and fascinating, in your games, and building them based on stuff that Lovecraft actually did. He sent out a PDF of the book, and then the book's being put together and printed after the fundraiser succeeded spectacularly. So it's been cool. I've been reading that and having a great time with his ideas, and the book itself is his ideas, but then he recruited several people to do margin notes in it. So Ken Height and Jason Morningstar, who wrote Fiasco and the role-playing game Gray Ranks, and Gareth, I believe it was Gareth Hanrahan was the other one, who was involved in the Laundry RPG, all kind of wrote lots of notes in the margins, kind of commenting on his ideas and his suggestions, and sometimes disagreeing sharply with him and explaining why they disagreed. And it's really great, fascinating reading. And it's actually some of the things he was suggesting in there has already inspired me to start to go back to a Delta Green campaign that I wrote a good bit of 10 or 15 years ago called Operation Sandman, and kind of start noodling ideas to put that back together in a way that's a little more compelling for me, because there were lots of elements of it that I really liked, and then some elements of it I ran into some walls and couldn't really figure out how to resolve them in a way that was good. So this has kind of given me some ideas for that. So I'm kind of going back slowly into that, and I'll see if I can come up with a very much more kind of tightened up version of that. The Sandman originally was put on the Delta Green website as another. It was run online in like internet chats, so we had the transcripts of all those chats over the course of about a year and a half, if I remember right, from 98 and 99 and 2000, that are still online. The campaign was never finished, but it was very fun. So overall, it's been fun to kind of go back to those ideas and see what I want to do with them.
Nice. I've wanted to. Yeah, it looks like a good book. I'll. Do you know if there are going to be any copies for sale at Gen Con? I kind of want to browse through it. I know it's for sale online.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not positive about that, but yeah. But I hope so, because it's very cool.
Yeah. Awesome. Hi, this is Russ Payton. We're back with Dennis Detwiller and, of course, Shane Ivey. We're going to be talking about game design, Call of Cthulhu, Delta Green, and Dennis, you've actually, you've just had the successful Kickstarter for the Delta Green novel, but through A Glass Darkly. But you're right now writing Delta Green Failed Anatomy. Could you talk about that a little?
Sure. Tell us about it. Yeah. First of all, I'd like to thank all the Delta Green fans out there for getting that Kickstarter going. We really needed the help, and you guys came through, and the book's looking great. So really excited to get it out there. Failed Anatomies, pardon me, is an anthology of Delta Green fiction set in different decades from the birth of Delta Green, from the sort of P Division late 1920s. Stuff all the way up to the modern day, and each story is kind of takes place in a snapshot of history that has to do with Delta Green. I've written I'd say it's about 70% done right now, or at least first draft done, and I just finished a fun story about a Russian scientist, and that's about it.
And we've had a couple of those up already online.
Oh yeah, that's right. Punching, which is a Delta Green story from the 1940s, and Intelligences, which is a Delta Green story set in the late 1920s. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, intelligence is the one that's it's sort of in's mouth's ramifications.
Yes, it's more about the idea that it's free online. I would read it.
Right. Those are both at theunspeakableoath.com, by the way.
Yeah, we'll have links in the show notes for this episode, so you can go there to get all the links to all the stories. Are these stories going to have like a particular theme, or they, or what was the overall goal for this anthology? Just to write it, or did you want to illuminate some specific part of Delta Green?
I just wanted to give a snapshot of the changing agency. Often I get approached with emails or people talking about, you know, a particular vision of Delta Green they have, and sometimes I think, wow, that's exactly right. But most of the time I think, oh my God, did I say that? You know, why are they thinking this? Why do they think Delta Green has access to like TAC nukes and helicarriers and jetpacks? So one of the things I was hoping to do with the book is just kind of illustrate the relentless drive that the group has in the face of ultimate destruction and the impossibility of winning. It's something that I feel like in Delta Green, we've said, me, John, and Scott, and Shane, and everybody who's worked on it, and Greg, have said a million times that no matter what you do, you're not going to win. You know, you can still struggle. The struggling part is what makes us human. But this book, hopefully, will reiterate the fact that Delta Green is an agency that will ultimately fail.
Right.
It can't win.
Yeah, and you may have occasional victories, but it's short-term victories. You know, I mean, ultimately, from a literary standpoint, you know, I mean, it's, you know, this is all about death, right?
Yeah.
And you don't beat death. You just either come to terms with it or you stave it off valiantly.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
I mean, even worse, the victories are extremely shallow and come at a humongous personal cost.
Right.
I mean, that's, to me, that's one of the most important things. You don't save the world. You stop the thing from materializing once, and it'll rematerialize 75 years from now and do the same thing it was going to do when you tried to stop it. And you might have lost two members of your team or become estranged from your wife or get fired from your job or go under federal investigation for skipping out of work, turning up illegally and flashing your badge, you know, two states over.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Delta Green.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, because this is something that I hear a lot, and I know the answer that I give, but I'm curious sort of how you look at it. And from a gaming standpoint, you know, what's your answer to when people say, what makes that fun?
What makes that fun is the struggle.
Yeah.
I mean, every Lovecraft story I've ever read fills that mold. It's utilizing cutting-edge technology in an attempt to stop the impossible. And it never works, or it comes very close to not working. I mean,
right. Well, you know, one thing I found interesting in Delta Green isn't necessarily the futilities that we as the players, the people playing the game, understand that we have a broader perspective. But the people in the Delta Green game, there's a lot of ambiguity to it.
Yes.
You know, there's a great sense of the unknown and uncertainty. In most of the Delta Green games, you know, things end and they're not quite fully resolved. And
yeah,
that's what I think is really great about it in a lot of senses, that so much of the Delta Green material I've seen is just like, we did this, we blew up the, you know, the mansion with the cultists, and we think we got it. We don't know.
We
did something and it stopped screaming and we ran away, you know?
Yeah, no, I really, you know, what's fun about that is, you know, that the gamer mindset, just gaming in general, seems to draw a particular type of person who wants to just close things up in a little bow and, you know, I rolled a 12 and it's over. Yay. You know? And personally, I've never found that very interesting. And a lot of people who I think are drawn to Delta Green, were also drawn to Call of Cthulhu for the same reasons. You know, when we play Cthulhu, I don't know about you guys, but you know, I'd say there's 60-70% casualties most of the time. Yeah. Because, you know, you wander in not knowing what's going on, and you're you know, I'm a local journalist. You know, you're a dead man if you walk into a Call of Cthulhu scenario. You're like, I want to know more. Let's read that book. No, that's not good. And Delta Green, what I like, the ambiguity, going back to that, what I like about that is there are many levels of deception in Delta Green. You know, the agency itself lies, cheats, steals, kills to get things done. It doesn't approach its newbie agents and go, we're in a legal conspiracy hunting evil things from beyond space-time that we can never win. You know, that they say things like, the supernatural is real and we're a federal agency tasked with stopping it. Mm-hmm. You know, that sounds really great until you've done your seventh op and you find out it's all a sham. And then what do? You don't retreat. They have information on you. You're complicit.
The big challenge there is sort of conveying to the Delta Green Keeper that, you know, your job is to make it look like Delta Green has all of the resources and authority and whiz-bang stuff that people want it to have. And but you need to know that it doesn't. You know, that's a front. And the players need to gradually uncover sort of the horror of the sort of nature of their struggle as they're uncovering the scope of what they're struggling against.
Yeah, I definitely say that's true. I mean, the other big thing I consistently hear is the minute I mentioned the monster, everybody knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think, why would you possibly call it a deep one? Why?
That's a big issue because you don't have to use the name, you know. I was running a New Age recently, and I'm going to talk about that on the podcast later. But you know, I mean, it's spoiler alert. It has Mego, you know, and the second you say you know, crustacean. With wings, you know, everybody knows what you're talking about. There's no secret. So you have to sort of, the only way around that is either not use those monsters that everybody knows about, or else acknowledge that the players know what they're dealing with, but present it in a way that's mysterious and scary anyway. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you can look at it like, I don't want to dominate the conversation here, but the way I look at it is like, you know, everybody knows, I mean, if you're watching Silence of the Lambs, you know, we all know what a serial killer is. We all know what Buffalo Bill is up to and what he's doing, and yet it's still horrifying.
Well, yeah, I think it's deeper than that, too. It's just, it's not that you might understand it, it's that you can't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
You go Mego, and the gamer goes, oh, it's a crustacean with wings from Pluto. Wrong. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you shoot it in the head with a shotgun and then it kills you.
Right.
It's non-Euclidean. It doesn't exist in our time space. You could blow it into a million different bits. It literally could reconstitute itself for all we care.
Mm-hmm.
The physical laws need not apply. And this is part of the... You know, it's not a D&D dungeon crawl,
right?
Call of Cthulhu,
right.
Ever, and it never should be. And if it is, if you find yourself going, well, you know, weapons impale, and it's 1 point, and okay, he's over the, you know, you're doing something wrong.
that was a discussion that went around and around on the Delta Green mailing list recently. Was about sort of the question of being slavishness to the rules, I guess. You know, the fact that there are game stats in there makes a lot of it makes it really kind of awkward for a lot of gamers to want to change those stats, you know. So when your response is don't be afraid to monkey with them, you know, ignore those stats, change them around, change the way that they respond to damage. I mean, you know, change it up. You don't. The players should not be confident that they know how to beat this threat just because they've run into something that looks like it before.
Yeah,
and that's a hard conversation. You know, a hard kind of conversation to have sometimes because gamers tend to like their rules, and a lot of times they tend to hate the notion of changing the rules as they go.
Well, right. You know, I mean, it just seems like then Call of Cthulhu is not for you.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, also, I think
why would it be joyless? I'm sorry, Ross. Go ahead.
Oh, it's good. Also, I think in the example you're mentioning, the Delta Green email list, they're also just not using the rule. They're using the rules incorrectly. And I think in the case they were talking about a Shoggoth that was easily defeated with firearms. And of course, the rules actually say that Shoggoths only take, you know, like 1 point of damage per attack, regardless of how many bullets you fire at it. Mm-hmm. And a Shoggoth's damage bonus is like plus 66. So a Shoggoth like just has to hit a guy once to kill them, more or less. You know, so I think the key isn't even necessarily bending the rules, but just being creative in your descriptions. Like, describe the monsters more like how Lovecraft would. I know, when you're talking about the Migu, you don't describe it as a crustacean with wings. You describe it as a horrible, indescribable, as a horrible mass of flesh that rise and moves in ways it cannot, and describe a Baiki as the horrible, you know, furred thing, clawed thing that is bursting through the door, and describe it as someone who's going through trauma would see it as just a blur, shape, something like that. That's how I've done it, and also focus on the other senses too, you know, the smell and the the touch of it and that sort of thing. So
yeah, well, the other thing a lot of people don't take into account is the intelligence of these things.
Yeah.
And you know, Scott Glancy got a little taste of that when we were running Owl's Head Mountain. that was a great sequence. Basically, for those who don't know the scenario, spoilers ahead, because it's a funny story. It's basically a dark young gets loose on a mountain and is running around trying to protect this kind of site. And it has an intelligence of, I forget, 12 or 13 or something. So, you know, the agents finally track it down and it's kind of hunting them, and it murders one of the party and then pins Scott's character to the ground and urinates on him. It just pisses all over him, which smells like chlorine and acid and is eating through his clothes, and he's screaming on the ground, and this is basically the Dark Young going, don't come up on the mountain, go tell other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's thinking, it's, you know, murdered one to say I can kill you, and then it took the other and kind of did a little dominance on him and let him loose, and Scott's character was like, we're not going up there anymore. Just not happening. So, you know, trying to figure out like a Biaki or Amigo, or come up with non-human responses or odd responses. Scott was expecting a full-on firefight and just some sort of huge confrontation where you'd be chucking dynamite or trying to take it out with an anti-tank rocket. And in exchange, this thing just humiliated his group and, you know, murdered their guide and then just kind of decided to show him a good time.
Right, right.
And it was a lot of fun. Scott was like, oh my God, that was awesome. So... that's the proper response to
treat the monsters as intelligent thinking things and as intelligent thinking totally alien unknowable things, and have them behave in ways that shock and surprise the players and that they can't predict.
Yeah,
and that'll go a long way.
Yeah, one of the deeper parts of horror of that scenario is that they were attempting to set up a weapon using stolen C4 to blow up one of the MacGuffins on the mountain, and one of the agents accidentally blew himself up.
Yeah.
And Scott had to dispose of the body, and that was a huge problem. He called ACEL and said what to do, and they said get rid of it.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, he had to wrap it in, I forget, tarpaulin and weight it down, and then stab the chest a couple dozen times. You know, he was basically lost a ton of sand because he was a crime scene investigator.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, how do I sink this so it doesn't come up? Okay, here's what the guys who got away with it did. Right. And it was not a lot of fun to do because he was just having dinner with this guy the night before.
Right.
Wow.
So that's Delta Green.
Yeah. Well, and you know, another thing that that I'm kind of curious what your attitude towards it is, that ties into that, is long-term play, you know.
Yeah.
And playing at a campaign that,
yeah.
I mean, I've when, you know, the my favorite long-term gaming experience ever was ages ago when I was in high school, I was a player in a long-term Call of Cthulhu campaign, you know, with recurring, the same recurring characters that sort of, you know, occasionally died out, and most of us sort of gradually, you know, had our sanity worn away, of course, and by the spiral, and it eventually, you know, completely imploded in catastrophe, but it was a long thing, you know. We played the same characters and the same kind of ongoing stories for a couple of years, if I remember
sure.
right. And so, what's your approach, or do you have one to kind of squaring the desire for players to kind of have an ongoing thing with the kind of inherent lethality of Cthulhu adventures?
You know, it's for me. I mean, I run very freeform stuff. You know, most of the scenarios that have kind of congealed out of my mind have been run just on the fly for a bunch of people based upon a single nugget.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, I'm going to make a building that's part Carcosa. Yay. And then I just make it up as I go along.
Okay.
And write it all down. And if the players have a good time, you know, if, like, I forget, it was Blair Reynolds left the room when I said something about the McAllister building from Night Floors, he was like, I gotta go, and just left the room. I was like, okay, I gotta write this down. This is good. It's upsetting people. And then he came back like, oh, goddamn, what was that? I knew I was onto something. Usually I just run stuff like that. And I've had long-term Call of Cthulhu campaigns, Club Apocalypse and Belial and all that stuff. The Fate comes from a long-term Call of Cthulhu campaign I ran that had nothing to do with Delta Green at the time. It was just about a bunch of dabblers trying to get into the occult in New York. It was Call of Cthulhu, most definitely. And, you know, we lost a lot of people over, I think it was a year and a half. I think, you know, most players went through two characters at least. One guy survived to the very end and, you know, was bitterly happy about that. But, you know, I look at those things and I think, let the chips fall where they may, as long as you guys can tell a fun story that keeps everybody engaged and wanting to play. I think overthinking it or trying to plan it or it's just, it never really works out. You can plan situations, you can't plan players' choices.
Right.
And that's my philosophy for writing scenarios is here's the situation and I'm going to write up as many of the possible outcomes as I can imagine, and try and give advice based on, you know, if the players do this, maybe you can try and do this to extend the play. But, you know, in all honesty, if you ever come to an impasse and you feel like there's no way out, you're not trying hard enough. There's always some fiction way out of every situation. And you are the game master. You're the keeper. You can do anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to make it consistent.
Now, it's interesting. You know, you're talking about doing a long-term Call of Cthulhu campaign. I've certainly done that as well. Of course, I used the one long Call of Cthulhu campaign I ran was Mass Annihilate Lothotep, which, of course,
yes.
had to get a slight player turnover issue or player character turnover. We had the same players. But the, you know, I was also thinking about, you know, you've written a lot of scenarios for Delta Green, and in some cases, some people have noticed that they tend to be very lethal in so many words. For example, I ran Artifact Zero, which will be posted as an Unspeakable Oath actual play at Gen Con. And, of course, that was the total party kill. That's from Delta Green. Is it Eyes Only, I think?
Yeah.
And there's also Future Perfect. So how do you design like these scenarios, which seem to be more, you know, for one shot standalone scenarios, differently than you would design a campaign? Or is it one school of philosophy? Do you I know the McAllister building, you know, I've also ran Night Floors, was certainly not as lethal. I mean, there are certainly ways characters could die, but not like Artifact Zero where
I don't know, we lost our entire party.
Oh yeah,
they never came back
from the McAllister building.
Yeah, they went upstairs and never came down. And that was fully mechanical. I had nothing. There was no GM kind of caveat involved, they had a lot of fun dying, and not so much dying, becoming shades of the McAllister building and living on the night floors forever. But it turned into a David Lynch film, and they had a great time. So,
now was that run as a one shot or was that a campaign?
That was part of ongoing characters.
Okay. So they it was total party wipe. They had to...
they were just gone. Yeah, and Delta Green sent in another group, and that was two people who finally busted. Yeah, you know, managed to close off the gate.
Was that a thing you played out, or was that an afterwards sort of explained it happened?
They played it out. They had the building demolished, and that was a lot of work. They basically set up a gas fire and then gutted the building during the day, got it condemned, and then through a shell company using Alzheimer's knocked it down. And in exchange, had to give up a book that turned out to be very bad later on.
So. Well, sure, I can give you the Necronomicon.
Yeah, no, it was I forget, Sithat Aquadungeon or something, Book of Blackwater. Fun stuff. The stuff I write, I generally come up with a nugget of an idea, like, what if an archaeologist could dig himself up? You know, or, you know, what if the top of the building just went on forever, you know, and then try and create something around that. Usually I just throw the agents in there and give, you know, write up three sentences and then just slowly flesh it out in gameplay. When I ran Artifact Zero the first time, we lost 3/4 of the group. When I ran it the second time, we lost nobody. And it was completely contingent on who was playing and what their skill sets were. The second time, we had a physicist in the group who immediately became suspicious of the, I think it's Thorley, the bones and the disappearing man. It was just like, we're not touching anything. And they were like, why? And he's like, well, we've just dug up modern man in like 8 million-year-old strata. So we're not touching anything.
Right.
And everybody was like, okay, whatever. And then people started disappearing and they were like, what do we do next? Suddenly this guy was like, you know, Jesus. They were like, what's happening? How do we fix it? So
he had the secret of not touching things.
Yes, he did. Which is generally a good policy.
Yeah.
But having said that, I mean, there's no difference between that and the Protomatter situation. You roll into Groversville and you start eating dinner, you're dead.
Right.
So, you know, the way I look at it is there's a long precedent in both Lovecraft and Delta Green of, guess what? It's already too late. What do you do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's common.
Yeah, and the you know, the exciting part is always not necessarily whether you win or lose, but how you deal with it, you know,
yeah.
And how you react.
Right.
So you've been talking about kind of your approach to creating tabletop scenarios, and one of the DGML guys was asking about that, but he also was curious if sort of how your approach to, and this is kind of radically switching gears, but he was curious if how your approach to tabletop games informs your approach to designing for video games.
I mean, it certainly helps, you know, in general in video games. I've worked on, you know, really large games and really small games, and the one thing I've discovered is that writing for tabletop makes you think harder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in video games, there's an urge to go, you know, why is the bad guy doing this? Because he's green. Okay. Let's move on, you know.
Meaning like you're thinking in terms of motivations and contingencies.
Yeah. I mean, in Prototype is a good example, like, it'd be very easy for that game to have been shipped without any of the web of intrigue. In fact, that would have been the default position of any publisher. It would have been like, well, it's a lot of money and, you know, let's just skip that.
Describe the web of intrigue for listeners that are...
Well, the character in Prototype, King, kind of, he's kind of a proto-matter
He is a Shoggoth, basically.
That was
how you pitched the game originally.
Yeah, right? So he's a human Shoggoth, basically. But he can consume and kind of become anybody. And when he gobbles them up, he can kind of sort through their memories. So the Web of Intrigue is him hunting through the memories of people who are involved in the conspiracy that created him. And each one's a little snippet of that person's mind, which kind of reveals a little bit more about what's really going on. And I think there are, 200 of them, and it took a hell of a long time to write, and they all kind of lead into each other. There's actually an interactive web. You can watch them over and over again and try and puzzle out what's going on. And you can even see monsters and kind of new enemies coming before they arrive. I'd say, yeah, my tabletop stuff definitely brought that, made that possible, and made me believe in it enough to pitch it that way. So, and it was one of the successes of the property. So,
yeah, it was I'm kind of surprised that I really enjoyed that part of the game, prototype,
cool.
Digging at the backstory, and of course getting to eat and consume Shane Ivey and Scott Lancey. That was pretty entertaining, but I was kind of surprised when you said that publishers would just assume it, because these sort of collectible kind of mini games seem to be very popular in games, but I guess it was just the writing a cutscene for each one. Is that it? Or
yeah, I mean, the default situation would be like, okay, go collect 300 flags.
Right.
I make one flag, one guy places it, it takes 2 days, versus, 6 months of drudgery. But it was, I feel like it came out well. It's just at the same time, like, the default position of publishers is cheap and fast, which is the antithesis of making anything good in video games, what I've discovered.
or in most anything else.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, well, not quite. In role-playing games, it's cheap, but it just takes a long time. So,
well, that's the thing, yeah. But, I mean, it's the old adage all over.
Yeah,
again.
Yeah. Cheap, fast, and good. Pick
right.
Two out of three.
Right. I don't know anybody that's managed to beat that, however hard we all try.
Right. Prototype is one of the things I also wanted to talk about a little more, because it is very much like a game that would be placed in Delta Green. In fact, I ran a Delta Green game using that as the basis for it.
Oh, cool.
where the players start out as journalists who are investigating the town of the stories behind New Hope, and then.
Right.
Then they go into
cool.
Manhattan, and it kind of fell apart in the second session when two of the players were new to Delta Green and Call of Cthulhu, and they wanted to go raid the police station for guns. And I was like, that's fine, but they're really not going to help you against all the hordes of things out there. Yeah. So the other players who loved investigation just got sick of it, and it collapsed after that. So
yeah, that's too bad.
Players do love their guns. I was just running a New Age, and that's again more spoilers, but that's one where you're sort of dealing.
It is like it's been out for a while, so
yeah. I mean, it was out since 15 years ago, so get over it. But yeah, that's what one of the early recurring threats, is basically these sort of proto-matter shape-shifting things, that are a little bit, they're like what's his name from Prototypes, kid siblings or something. But it's the kind of monster where shooting it doesn't help, stabbing it with a knife doesn't help, and yet time after time my guys would run into one of these things and they just could not stop themselves from trying to shoot it to death. It was hilarious, like over and over and over again, even after they learned that they were vulnerable to fire,
they're still just shooting it.
Oh yeah, they would still just be blazing away with the guns.
They deserve to die. So
yeah, they managed not to, but it was really hysterical to watch the process.
Yeah, I mean, Delta Green, when John or whoever ran it back, Scott, back in the early days before it was really even out there, mostly involved running away.
Right.
or screaming and dying in a corner, or, like, eating a bullet. You know, and I guess I still try and write it like that. You know, it wouldn't be fun to, for me personally, and you know, I don't know. I'm one of the creators, so I hope it's kind of the general gist. I think Scott agrees. I know John agrees. It wouldn't be fun for me if you could go, "Hey, we won!" You know, I kick Cthulhu's ass. I shot him in the face with a Barrett. It's awesome.
Right.
That's just not fun. you know, that's Dungeons and Dragons. I'll go play Dungeons and Dragons. So
yeah, it's you know, the thing that makes that tricky is for me is always player buy-in. You know, you've got to make sure that your players are on the same page as you. So when I was running a New Age, I actually kind of had the kid gloves on a few times. Or ordinarily I wouldn't at all, but this was a group that it was a mixed group. You know, and I knew that they were kind of coming into it not knowing exactly what to expect. And so I kind of erred a little bit on the side of being too merciful, you know. And after the case, I kind of saw a couple of points where I really shouldn't have, but in the middle of things, it didn't occur to me, you know. So and the reason I did that was basically I didn't want to completely turn off everybody. You know, I knew that I had some people in there that were that were all in, you know, and that they would be totally happy with the TPK as long as it was an exciting, funny TPK, you know, or even better, spooky, chilling one. But but then, you know, I know I had a couple of other players that this was all new, you know, and they were just sort of trying to figure out what it was all about. And so my concern was, you know, going through this and playing it, you know, as hard ass as I can, but then that resulting in an experience that was going to turn off, you know, some of the players.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, like, I shifted gears in, I don't know, 1985, I guess. I was playing GURPS. Before that, you know, our group was fantasy-based GURPS stuff.
Right.
And then I just found Call of Cthulhu and was like, oh, boy, we're going to play this. And I just murdered them relentlessly until they caught on. And then the group just freaking loved it. Yeah. They didn't want to play anything else.
Yeah.
So I've often found that if you coddle people, they tend to react. They don't learn.
Yeah.
That they just keep doing what they were doing. They're like, you know, I'm going to steal a gun, or, you know, the standard stupid operating procedures that, you know, I'm going to sit on the grenade, or, you know, you're like, what the why? What are you saying? Like, why? Because it'd be funny. Haha. You're just like, oh, get out of here. It's almost worth not playing with those people.
Well, I guess that's the key is you know,
people you can play with. Yeah.
What I was thinking is you have to sort of, you know, let the shit happen. And if it's gamers, if it's players that are not going to be into it, you know, then you might as well know that. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say that's better. I mean,
and if that means you don't play that game, then don't play that game. You know, there's other games out there.
Okay. One sort of caveat. I mean, I do kill players, as you listen to the podcast and you can listen to that. But I tend to have reservations killing them depending on what time it is in the actual session, because unless they're doing something really dumb like sitting on grenades or whatever. Unfortunately, my group isn't prone to doing that usually, but not always. I try not to kill them at the beginning or even towards the middle of the session because of the pure metagame level. I don't want somebody who gets kicked out of the game and has no way of rejoining it. You know, they came over and, you know, they've been playing for 30 minutes and a bad die roll, and now they have to set out for the next 3 hours or whatever. So, of course, then on the other hand, at the end of the session, I get a little more bloodthirsty, where I'm more like, all right, let the dice roll where they may, and if you die, you die. I mean, whatever. So I don't know. Do either of you ever think about that kind of, you know, on a meta level? Like, well, if I kill him now, he's not going to be able to play. You know, he's just going to be sitting out for the rest of the week.
A good example is when John playtested in Media Res, I died within the first 15 seconds. I mean, literally. Yeah. Like, probably even less than that. And then I got to terrorize the group as someone else. So that was a lot of fun.
Right.
But But that's
kind of an anomalous scenario, though.
Yeah.
Because for the listeners, in media res was an oath scenario where basically you start off not knowing who your characters are, like,
right,
at all, you know, and it turns out they're, you know, psychopaths. But,
well, let me put it this way.
They're player characters. Of course they're psychopaths.
In Owl's Head Mountain, that guy died within 15 minutes. You know, he blew himself up.
Right.
You know, from what I hear a lot, it's like, oh, no, what do I do? And I'm thinking, this is awesome. I'm not thinking, how do I save this scenario? I'm thinking, this is the scenario.
Right.
Now you have a corpse of a federal agent. What do you do, group?
Yeah.
And every other Keebler, when I've gone to convention games and stuff, they just step past that point.
Yeah. And
I'm like, well, what the hell? Like, we just murdered a family of six.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, we didn't mean to blow up their house, but they're all dead. And, you know, our fingerprints are all over this area.
Right.
What do we do? You know, that's awesome. To me, that's the fun.
Yeah.
You know, so the guy got derailed. The guy blew himself up. I forget. He fumbled his explosives roll. He had like a 70 explosive skill or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he just blew his arm off and died horribly. You know, he had a grand time.
Yeah.
He came back in as another operative. They just sent in another guy later on. So right. That's what Delta Green's for, is for replacing these guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's how I look at it.
I've kind of gone both ways. There have been times where I kind of deliberately avoided letting a character get killed, just because I didn't like the timing. But then I think there's also room for, for just letting the crazy shit happen when it's shocking and it doesn't make any sense at all, you know? But I guess that also kind of comes down to paying attention to timing as well. I don't know. I'm a little proactive about that, but, because mainly, I don't know. I think usually it comes up to just feeling like, does this feel like a time when, having somebody get killed is going to be interesting, you know, or is it just going to be a pain in the ass?
Yeah. I do have to remember one time a player did die in the middle of the scenario, and I felt kind of bad because he didn't die because of a really stupid decision. He just died because he was fighting some zombies and made one too many bad dice rolls, should have run, and they'd ambush him. He didn't have much of a chance. So I said, you know, the evil spirit that's possessing this cabin, you're causing this dead rise up, he's going to raise you as a zombie. So I'll let you control for the zombies when they try and kill the other players. And unfortunately, the players were rolling really well that night, so they killed him a second time with the shotguns.
Well, still, that sounds like fun. That sounds like a good
He had a good time, especially getting to die twice in the same scenario.
Right.
With the same character. I mean, that's not too. You can't. That's harder to do. That's a.
So I mean, I'm very much of the mechanical aspects of my Call of Cthulhu games tend to follow the uncaring, relentless mechanical universe that Lovecraft loves so much.
Right.
So you know, if the guy fumbles and shoots himself in the leg, he bleeds out in the car. Everybody's screaming and trying to get him to a hospital without getting indicted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not. Well, you know, let's skip that.
Well, and part of the value of that is that, you know, with a role playing game, you're not writing a story, you know, you're not creating a story on a structure, you know, on a framework, on an outline. You know, the story is what sort of emerges, or at least this kind of role playing game. I mean, there are plenty out there that that approach it in a more proactive way, but. But, you know, the Call of Cthulhu is all about, you know, the story is what you discover as a consequence of the player's choices in this weird-ass situation and the luck of the dice.
Yeah, know? Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, your job is not to worry about the mechanical issues as much as to worry about freaking the players out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, so.
And the mechanics in Call of Cthulhu do, you know, they do their job
Yeah, they kill players very, very effectively. I've never had any problems.
Right.
You know, speaking of, just as an aside, you know, speaking of game mechanics, I was just wondering if you, Dennis, if you've taken a look at Trail of Cthulhu and the Gumshoe system, if you wanted to comment on the differences between that and Call of Cthulhu. You know, the main, yeah. For those of you who aren't familiar, Trail of Cthulhu, the Gumshoe system, Robin Laws and Pelican Press, they put it out to solve what they perceived as the central problem of Call of Cthulhu, which was you fail your spot hidden check or your research check or whatever, you fail to get the clue. In Trail of Cthulhu, the clues are given to you automatically, and you can spend your character points, your abilities, as to gain better clues or a better advantage, yeah, in certain
situations. Or better situations. Understanding.
So it's more under the control of the player, and so it's about interpreting the clues rather than actually finding them or not. So
I mean, I love what Robin does. I think it fits very specific Lovecraft stories. It feels to me like The Call of Cthulhu and The Haunter of the Dark very, very specifically would work well under those rules. But I think it, for me personally, I forget, there was a little PDF that came out a couple months ago, Cthulhu Dark, is it called? Those rules seem to work a lot better for me. It's like something attacks you, run away. If you don't run away, you're dead. You know, to me, that's much more Lovecraftian than I'm in control of the situation. Not only am I in control, I'm going to exert further control on this situation, figure out what's going on. That, to me, that's not really Lovecraftian. That's kind of like I find all the clues and I realize what's going on and it's awful. and I can't do anything about it or I die. Those. You know, so you know, like mechanically, I think it's smart, but it basically, it's there's few differences between it and going, okay, no more spot hidden rolls.
Right. Well, the big problem that I see in Call of Cthulhu in the rulebook is that the rulebook does a lousy job of telling players and keepers when to call for a roll and when not to. You know, it does a bad job of giving you a sense of what's it going to mean for that emergent story when in this situation you require a skill roll to succeed. When should you leave it to chance and when shouldn't you? You know, and that's something that Cthulhu sort of has always assumed that you just sort of figure out, you know. But a lot of times it takes a long time for players to figure that out. And that means that a lot of game groups kind of go through a lot of bad games until they suddenly figure out, oh, wait, you know.
Yeah.
If I ask for a role here, that means there's only a 50-50 chance that it's actually going to happen. So I better not ask for a role here. You know, I better just describe it or whatever. And that's the core of the problem, you know. And I think Trail's answer to that, you know, is sort of mechanically it's interesting and elegant. But it leads to a pretty different kind of experience. You know, you're managing resources, you know, with those points. And that's kind of a different tone and different attitude.
I'd say it puts the player in the mindset of control of the situation, which I think is a mistake.
Well, and then you've got, as the GM, as the keeper, you have to kind of struggle against that. It's sort of a different thing to kind of to pay attention to. I mean, by the same token, I mean, you know, we've had people ask about, you know, Delta Green done in some of the other kind of indie systems, you know. So there's the Fate role-playing system is a huge kind of indie darling at this point. And it's a brilliant system, and it does a great job of certain kinds of games. But it's one that I personally wouldn't turn to for this kind of a horror game, you know, because it's a system that puts, you know, it sort of gives the players a little more narrative power, and there's nothing wrong with that. But with Delta Green, when I'm running it, at least I want to kind of, you know, I want the players to feel a little bit of the helplessness of their characters, you know. And so there's a potential that your game suffers for that if you're a dick GM, you know, or you're not very imaginative. But But you know, if the players have a sense that they're holding on to, that they can affect the way the world looks, you know, at some point if they need to, then that's, to me, that always feels like one element of hope too much for this kind of horror.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Switching topics slightly.
I wanted to go back.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to the one of the first things we talked about, which is, of course, your writing, and go a little more into Through a Glass Darkly, because, again, you know, as said, the Kickstarter was such a success, but not everybody is familiar with the Delta Green fiction canon. So you could sort of like place it in the context of the other Delta Green stories, and you know, and then describe where it is in terms of, you know, production and all that.
Sure. As far as where it is in the fiction canon, it's an attempt to kind of move the Delta Green fiction canon forward from the 90s towards the, you know, the more modern era. It doesn't take place. It takes place just before September 11th, basically. So it's about the way the conspiracy has changed. It's about the changing guard of, you know, Alphonse leaving the leadership of the conspiracy and his fate and what happens. And so Scott has another novel that's kind of in between it and the Rules of Engagement. So it goes Rules of Engagement, Scott's novel, which I believe is called Those Who Win, still underway, and Through a Glass Darkly. So yeah, what else did you want me to say? I'm sorry.
Well, where it is in terms of production.
Oh, sure. Shane just got
back. I can tell you, I can answer that more closely. It's I did the layout for it, and because it's a novel, it's easy layout, so people that, you know, hate the layout work I've done in the past, you don't have to fear too much. But basically I finished the layout for it, and I'm going to probably this week recruit a few people to give it a proofreading pass, and, you know, if we can get some volunteers maybe to each read a chapter or two and send me any typos they find, then that'll save us some embarrassment. And after that, basically, it's going to the printer, and you know, and then we'll put the ebook version online. So it's actually very, very close. I mean, we're within probably if we recruit some volunteers this week and give them a week to read a chapter and send any corrections, then you know, then we're probably 2 or 3 weeks from having the ebook in distribution and having it printing at the press, and then after that it'll be another basically 6 weeks before it starts shipping to individual supporters, and then it'll be a few weeks after that we'll make it available for sale for everybody else.
Cool.
Great. And that actually, the idea of finding out what happened to Alphonse is actually very interesting to me, because that's always been one of the things I've wondered about, is how long he is going to hang around. Because context, Alphonse is a veteran of OSS, and is, I think, even in the original Delta Green book, he's in his 80s or 90s.
He was in the 95 manuscript for Delta Green. I think he was 78 years old.
78.
Yeah.
And so he's also
this story, Through a Glass Darkly, basically takes the story into early 2001. So in which case he's in his 80s and he's definitely feeling it.
Yeah. And also, not only is he this old OSS agent, former agent, he is now like the librarian at the Library of Congress. And in game terms, he is a very, very accomplished sorcerer.
Yes.
He knows quite a few rituals and spells. So the question is, what happens when the leader of Delta Green, or one of the leaders of Delta Green, you know, is in his 80s, has, you know, very dangerous mythos knowledge and power at his command? You know, what's going to happen with him? You're not going to put him in a senior retirement home. I mean,
right.
You
know. I wouldn't say at his command, but I'd say he definitely pays for all of it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, he has access to it, I should say.
Yeah. But I mean, at the end, it all comes down to that. So.
Right. Right.
You'll see in the book.
Great. Look forward to seeing that. So aside from writing, what are you doing now? I mean, we've talked about some of your video game work in Prototype, but...
Yeah, I'm still working in video games. I just moved to San Francisco to take a full-time job as a senior game designer at PlayFirst. They're one of the larger iPhone publishers, and... doing a bunch of stuff there I can't really talk about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's true.
PlayFirst is best known for Diner Dash, which is a really, really fun, addicting iPhone and iPad game.
Yes. And besides that, I'm working on a bunch of stuff. Failed Anatomy is probably top of the list. I'm writing another Delta Green scenario that doesn't really have a name right now.
Is it going to be another Ransom, or?
I don't know. I'll just finish and play test it and see if anybody likes it before I try and get it out there.
Fair enough.
I've had stinkers just like everybody else. And I'm also working on There Were Giants in Those Days, which is a rather large historical background of the world of Godlike, written as if it all happened. I'm about 300 pages. Yeah, I'm about 300 pages into the manuscript right now. And it's kind of, it's almost like a it's like an Ambrose book about the superhumans in World War II and their impact on combat. And so it's an entire kind of history of the war. And it's a lot of fun. It's a chunk of it's available up on my website right now, covering the first Superman and his impact on the invasion of Poland. Godlike still holds a really, really warm place in my heart. I just love the background and love the war and all that kind of stuff. So I'm a big buff.
Yeah. For any Oath listeners that aren't somehow familiar with it, Godlike basically started off as, it was originally going to be Pagan Publishing's first standalone role-playing game. I mean, this is like 10 years ago. And that didn't really happen, but it was sort of developed by Pagan Publishing. And then eventually, I mean, with Scott Glancy editing and John Tynes editing and doing the page design on it. And, of course, Dennis wrote it with Greg Stolze. And so they worked with Dennis and Greg and the Pagan guys, then worked with a new company that was at the time called Hobgoblin Press to publish it, and then stuff happened, and Dennis and I formed Arc Dream to take over publishing it, and have been sort of noodling around with it ever since. So right now, in fact, for the next week and a half or so, we're running a ransom to drum up the capital to convert the original Godlike rulebook over to a PDF release. And the reason we have to do that is basically it was laid out 10 years ago in some ancient version of PageMaker where the conversions no longer work quite right, so we can't just do a clean export. It's going to take a lot of tinkering to kind of get it done right. So we're basically holding this ransom to kind of drum up the cash to make that happen, and then we can do a PDF release of the original rulebook, which will be nice because the hardcovers are almost entirely sold out now. I mean, you'll still be able to find them in the secondary market and everything, but they'll be kind of harder and harder to find. If anybody hasn't played it yet, go to arcdream.com and look at the links to Godlike, and you'll find umpteen million previews and free downloads and things that'll give you a sense of what it's like. It's World War II. It's not Cthulhu Mythos, but Godlike basically has it. Sort of has the it's like superhero role playing, seen through the lens of people who love Deltagreen and horror, you know. So it's very kind of hard edge. It's not tentacles and stuff, but it kind of has that edge to it. It's meant to play more like, you know, Band of Brothers or Saving Private Ryan than Captain Marvel and his all-stars.
Well, Band of Brothers as written through the perspective of, like, say, Alan Moore's Watchmen or something like that, you know. Sure. On the low end, you know. Yeah. You have certainly the you know, at what price is power, and, you know, that kind of from I'm not as familiar with Godlike, but there does seem the characters seem to be very frail and human compared to, you know, stereotypical superheroes. I mean, are there any particular comics that you would I'm trying to think of series like Powers and other ones where they focus more on the frailty of
I think Godlike's interesting to me just because of the conceit behind the Godlike universe. Is these people turn up with powers that violate physical laws and no one has any conventional explanation. And there's a character who can fly, you know, at 600 or 700 miles an hour and turn at right angles. and science has no answer for that.
Right.
And the world goes on. So to me, that's kind of interesting. And then what are the applications of that? I can fly at 700, 800 miles an hour and turn at right angles. Well, I can do that right next to an aircraft and blow all of its control surfaces off, shatter the windscreen. You know, I basically sonic boom within a couple feet of an aircraft. I can send it spiraling out of the air. But, you know, once they put up a proximity fuse weapon, they can shoot me down. So I'm dead. So, yeah, it's Godlike is, I think the quote is, you are larger than life, but the war is larger than you.
Mm.
So the idea is just I wanted to build a world where there could be 100,000 superhumans and World War II would continue.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the game mechanics are built to make that happen. It's constructed really elegantly to facilitate that, where the way that superhumans, people with these superpowers, talents, interact with each other, and the way that their powers work on each other is limited in ways that kind of make sure that superpowers don't completely dominate the narrative of the war.
Yeah.
And that informs how the individual interactions and adventures kind of play out too. It's really cool. I mean, for years that's been sort of one of my favorite games to run of all the stuff that we've put together and put out. It's still I can go into any convention and run a Godlike game and know that I'm going to come out having had a terrific time.
It works really well.
it's cool stuff.
What else am I working on? I have 1,000,004 fiction projects floating in the void. I'm working on a post-apocalyptic story called Aftermath, and that is after space math. And the idea is physics just starts to kind of stop working consistently across the globe, and what happens?
Hmm.
becomes a very personal apocalypse for a character trying to get to his brother at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
His brother is kind of like the end-all be-all target because, of course, he'll know what's going on. He's a physicist. All the weirdness this character has to encounter. And I'm working on what else? Yeah, just way too much stuff to even list.
Right. Well, okay, I've got another email question here.
Sure.
David Jacobs from the mailing list, he says, he wants to know what happened with the other half of the Sense of the Sleight of Hand Man, that the first half of it was in Worlds of Cthulhu. And we've talked about, I don't even remember what the stat, that we've kind of come back to that every few months trying to figure out
what
it is. So tell us where it is, Dennis.
I have extensive notes.
By extensive notes, I mean about 65,000 words, second half. It's actually, I would say, the third. There's another section that has to come after it. I guess the truth is I got paid for the first half.
Right.
So I finished it.
I'm not familiar with this at all.
I'll give you a briefing. Someone
bitched out the Dreamlands in front of me at a convention, and I went, "That's wrong." So to rally against the light, I basically leapt out there and I'm like, "I'm going to write the Dreamlands like Lovecraft would have wanted them." And
well, what was their take on it? That
they were like, "Yeah, it's stupid. And they're mermaids, and it's not scary." And I'm just like, "God, you're dumb." Was my response. So I went off and wrote The Sense of the Sleight of Hand Man is a very large Dreamlands campaign where the main characters are all opium junkies in the 1920s in New York. And they're kind of deep in the pockets of this local opium dealer who owns the local Tong gang. And he forces them to smoke this odd drug called Biwandine, this type of opium. And it turns out he's a dealer of souls in the Dreamlands. And he sells bodies to the moon beasts in this other world. And the opium addicts wake up in the Dreamlands and these kind of other bodies and have to struggle to find their way out back to Earth. It's this dark, kind of evil, scary, really, nice. Really, you know, you have to travel through the city of the Gugs or trade with the ghouls or, you know, it's the first half, or I should say first third, is available for free download. It was in Worlds of Cthulhu, and it's a really fun scenario. I've run all of it, hence the remaining notes, to great acclaim. We had a lot of fun. We had one, you know, ghoul conversion. One of the PCs became a ghoul, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
It was really, really good. So I tried to write a really dark David Lynch kind of feeling to it. It's very surreal and odd, and it's more about how I would imagine you'd want to run Dreamlands if you want to maintain that creepiness and use the sand loss and, like, you know, so.
Yeah, with the Dreamlands, it always, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the Dreamlands that feels, you know, it's
goofy.
It feels kind of goofy. It feels cutesy, you know? And so it's too easy to think that means that it's not scary when it's a different kind of scary, you know? And and even the Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, you know, I mean, he set out, it was a Dunsany story, you know, so he set out to make it very dreamy, of course, and to make it very kind of weird and you know, and to have a lot of this sort of fantastical stuff. And so it doesn't play out with the same kind of frights and terrors as normal Cthulhu stuff set in the real world, so to speak. But that doesn't mean that it's not creepy and awful in parts. And that's what you need to convey when you're playing it.
Yeah.
You know, I think the Dreamlands, more than anything else than Cthulhu, you know, touching back early on how you look at monsters and the rules in the Call of Cthulhu and you just need to, you know, make them your own in order to make things scary. You know, instead of making a Migu a crustacean with wings, you make it, an indescribable, you know, horrible, monstrous thing. So, like, the Dreamlands is a perfect example of how to take this. I think it's really ripe for reinterpretation. I mean, it's overlooked by a lot of people. And like you said, and there's a lot of detractors. So, like, making your characters opium addicts trying to get your souls back, you know, trying not to have a fate worse than death is a good start. I mean, if anything's perfect for, like, you taking, like, say, the movie Inception, And throwing it in, you know, a Call of Cthulhu perspective, I think the Dreamlands would be it.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of room there, and now I kind of want to. I've always had ideas with the using the Dreamlands. I haven't used it very much in my own games, but
cool. I should give props to the guy who gave me this idea, which is John Crow. We ran through Realm of Shadows as playtesters, this 1940s ghoul epic that John Crow wrote for Pagan. Mm-hmm. In there, he had this horrific, I forget, formula 531 or something like that. You know, the ghouls were experimenting with narcotics that could take you directly to the Dreamlands. And when you took it, you woke up in the city of Zul Basir, this weird kind of Middle Eastern city, where anybody who died within the city walls was rushed to the central temple by these priests wearing gold skull masks. And it turns out they're all ghouls, and they eat the bodies. Mm-hmm. And it was just this horrific, like, it was just so terrifying the way he ran it. Yeah. That I was like, oh boy, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Interesting. They're almost shadows. I haven't heard much about that.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's great. It's basically in the sort of early mid '90s, Pagan released a pair of campaigns by Crow, Coming Full Circle, and then Realm of Shadows. And yeah, they were sort of stretched from the late '30s into the '40s.
Gotcha.
And they were both really non-typical Cthulhu campaigns, you know. Yeah. So Coming Full Circle was, you know, had a lot of stuff with ghosts and hauntings and
vampires and
all kinds of, you know, and ways to kind of make things that felt like sort of more classic gothic horror tropes good and scary.
Oh yeah.
And so Realm of Shadows was sort of kind of a sequel to Coming Full Circle, and it dealt squarely with ghouls and sort of uncovering things that, you know, that these groups of ghouls are doing.
And
ghouls doing ghoul stuff that's awful and scary, so that it sort of and that also kind of gets away from, you know, it becomes a little too tempting to think of the ghouls as sort of the not so bad monsters in Cthulhu mythos, because, you know, look how nice they were to Randolph Carter, you know.
Yeah.
But then again, they're ghouls, you know. Yeah. So there's not a shortage of ways to make them horrible, and that's what Realm of Shadows definitely does. It kind of explores a lot of the stuff in the kind of ghoul mythology that evolved in the Cthulhu mythos. That's really cool. It's good stuff.
Yeah.
Hard as hell to find. I mean, it's been out of print for 10, 15 years, but if you can, they're both terrific. It's
best work. Just curious, I looked it up on eBay. There's one copy of The Realm of Shadows right now going for $90.
It's worth it.
Yeah.
But you can't have mine.
We'll have to keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, it's got some of my favorite art in it as well. Blair Reynolds just blew the doors off.
Oh yeah, God, Blair's art in those books was staggering.
Yeah, no, it's some of the best Call of Cthulhu art ever, mm-hmm. by far.
Nice. So we've got another mailing list question for you here, and he wants to know if is there a this is Brett Kramer again. He says, is there a published scenario that you consider a platonic ideal of the form? It's a two-part question, but answer that one first.
Wow, that's a tough one. let me think. Scenario or campaign? I mean,
either one.
Mask of Nyarlathotep is the definitive Call of Cthulhu campaign and will always be.
Mm-hmm.
The original mask, not this like revised. Well, everything in the kitchen sink masks.
For the listeners, why do you say that?
It taught the world how to run an ongoing Call of Cthulhu campaign. It extended Call of Cthulhu from a single scenario to this world-spanning cults, and it did it in a serious, fun manner.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't goofy. It wasn't, you know. And I was lucky enough to have a keeper who ran it properly. Jackson Elias teamed around with our campaign for 3 sessions or 4 sessions beforehand as an NPC.
Right, right.
And then we found him gutted in a apartment in New York, and
yeah. which isn't much of a spoiler because that's how the campaign starts.
No, that's definitely. Yeah, I don't think you can spoil Masking Girl. That type's been out since, what, 85?
Right.
You know, there are probably listeners who weren't born yet.
what's different about the revised big version? Because that's the version
most people are
going to
get. It becomes kind of like Lynn Willis decided, let's add in everything in the kitchen sink to expand the page count and resell it.
I actually ran the revised one. So you know, I mean, it added Australia, but I mean, I've never seen the original, so I
the original
consider the
is
revised.
About...
Yeah. So.
Oh, go, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say I consider the original or the revised the only Mass Annihilator because that's also the only one I could get. So.
Yeah. No, it's. I mean, the original book. It's actually originally a box set.
Yeah, that's how I played in it when it first came out.
Yeah, but the book, the original book, I believe, was 256 pages, maybe?
At most, yeah. The box set was basically a collection of real thin saddle-stitched booklets, you know?
Yeah.
And basically there were maybe 6 or 8 chapters, you know? And that each had its own little booklet and its own set of props.
Yeah,
like that badass matchbox that it came.
Yeah, from, yeah, it was awesome. Stumbling Tiger Bar.
Yeah,
Shanghai Fun and Friends.
Yeah, so would you recommend, like, if people are getting revised masks now, that's this big 400 page tome, you know, would you recommend just cutting out some chapters and running a more streamlined version?
Yeah, you know, I read both and. The expanded version I read was just kind of like, oh no, not that. You know, what, seriously? Now you're hunting, you know, lobster men? What's going on here? You know, it just seemed totally random, some of the stuff they added in. And, for me, there was a purity to the first book. It just was just perfect.
Where you're following this particular thread.
Yeah, and it's not 3 different stories told in tandem. It's this one main thing, with occasional red herrings that always bring you back to the point. For me, that is the paradigm of Call of Cthulhu construction. You'll notice a lot of my concepts follow the same methods that Tio did, which is here's the situation, and here are possible outcomes. And here are possible realms of investigation. It's not this happens, then this happens, then this happens. Mm-hmm. It's like on this date they're going to launch a rocket that's going to bring back Nyarlathotep. What are they going to do? I don't know. Here are the couple different places they can go, and here are all the clues involved. Go to town.
Yeah.
And to me, that differs significantly from nearly every main Dungeons and Dragons scenario I've read or other. They read much more like here's room 6 and read this to the players.
Yeah, I've spoken to Larry DiTilio a couple of times over the last few months, he's expressed an interest in doing some more Cthulhu writing. I'm trying to kind of encourage that because he's, you know, I mean, he basically. He did Masks, and he did a few other things. He did a few other game projects that aren't as well known, but you know, it didn't pay the bills for him any more than it does for hardly anybody else, you know. So he kind of he's a TV writer, so he had this entire career writing for television, and so he's just recently pretty much retired from that. You know, I mean, he's like 60. Years old, you know, 60 something years old now, so he's retired from that. But last time I spoke to him, he said he still, you know, he runs, he actually still runs Cthulhu occasionally at, you know, at local LA, you know, in Southern California cons that he goes to. He said there's this one recurring adventure that he runs, that, you know, he basically runs it for laughs, but it's sort of the Three Stooges and some sort of classic, you know, early 20th century, you know, characters, you know, in horrible Cthulhu situations, you know, and it sounds like it's basically just a goofy, fun adventure. kind of thing. So yeah. So if I flake out and forget, remind me to get back in touch with Larry to tell you.
Okay. Yeah, no joke.
You know, I do have to say about Masanori Ohtatep, my book, Road Trip, with the campaign for Monsters and Other Childish Things, which is up for an Innie this year.
Which is up for an Innie for Best Adventure. And yes. It's in competition. We're in the thrilling quandary of competing with ourselves this time, because in the Best Adventure category, they
wait. Who else is up? We're up in Best Adventure twice.
Yeah. Road Trip is up for Best Adventure, and then they put Targets of Opportunity, the new Delta Green book.
Screw you, Ross. I'm going to win.
I have a podcast, and I'll use it.
That's right.
Just kidding.
Yeah, the amazing thing with Targets there is that, like, Targets of Opportunity was the first Delta Green book to not have an adventure in it.
Yeah, technically, it's just the supplements of the different factions or new mythos factions you can use.
But I think, they're good that they decided to put it in Best Adventure anyway.
Yeah, but my point was that Road Trip, I specifically modeled on the Masanori Ohtatep, structure, in that it's a non-linear, like, there's several different locations throughout the country in Road Trip that you can visit in any order. The Game Master can run in any order he chooses. And there's always a clue linking from one location to the other location, the postcards that are non-specific. So you could run it from New England, then to California, then to Vegas, or you could do it Florida, Vegas, and then, New England, or whatever you wanted to do. So I loved Masanori Ohtatep so much, I shamelessly ripped it off in terms of structures.
Well, that's the way you run. That's the way you run a good campaign is, whether it's Call of Cthulhu or anything else, is you figure out what's the situation that the characters are going to get involved with. What's the situation and how's it going to play out if no player characters stumble into it and start acting like lunatics, and then let them stumble into it and act like lunatics and see where it takes it, where it takes that situation from there. That's the way to do it. And the alternative is you build something with the player characters in mind, but then you inevitably wind up making a railroady scenario, that feels like a very forced kind of thing where you've written it depending upon the player characters doing certain investigative things. But then if they don't, then you're kind of stuck, So Masks, that was its sort of genius, was it, they figured out, Larry figured out early on that that's the way to present an adventure. And it's a way that, it's this thing that's kind of unique to the form. It's a way of presenting this dramatic kind of horrific adventure that you couldn't really do in any other medium. And that's where long-term role-playing games really shine.
Yeah.
But that's my answer. That's the, to me, that's always going to be the best.
Right. So Brett's other question was, which of your own works are you most proud of?
Ooh.
Don't you hate that question?
Yeah, I do. God, what a dick. No, I'm just kidding. sorry.
Kidding, Brett.
Yeah.
We love you,
Well,
Brett.
How about just limited to your Call of Cthulhu work?
Sure.
Or even more specifically, which of your scenarios are you most proud of?
It's another tough one. I don't know. I really like Night Floors.
Honestly, that's my favorite of your works as well. Speaking of ripping people off shamelessly, I mean, I've used it as the basis for several other Haster-themed adventures.
That's good.
I told you about the one set in the shopping mall where the characters wake up as security guards and they have machine guns and they're wondering what's going on, and then they realize that they're in Carcosa and things are just going go downhill from there.
Why do you say that one's one of your favorites, Dennis?
Because it reinforces everything I was saying earlier, which is there's no way to win, really.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the guys who managed to demolish the McAllister, one of the characters lost enough sand so they kind of had permanent effects. And I forget exactly what happened. I think he, oh yeah, no, that's right. He he was committed eventually because he was convinced everyone was wearing masks. and he couldn't keep it in anymore. He was basically just started freaking out and trying to pull masks off, I think, his supervisor, the FBI.
Right.
And then he was committed, and he cut his own face off with a scalpel that he stole from an orderly,
nice.
Saying, "I wear no mask," and pulled his face off. And that was the end. but anyway, yeah, so he never really won. I say that because it kind of illustrates the point. It's this floating amorphous horror that's is really difficult to even comprehend, much less really understand. There's no clear way to stop it, and even when it's stopped, it's not really stopped. It's still doing something else. And I've always had a strong love of surreal horror. So.
Yeah. David Lynch's stuff, you know, is very...
Yeah.
Some of the scariest out there. I was trying to think. Which of your own work? You know, this question about which of your own work you're most proud of, I always think back to the film director Fellini, who always said, "It's whatever movie I just made, you know, whatever movie I'm trying to sell. That's the one I'm most proud of. Go see that, you know."
Yeah. Stanley Kubrick said it best. Every project, whenever he'd write someone to be in his movie, he'd write a letter and say, "This is the single greatest movie I will ever make."
Right.
you know, obviously.
Yeah.
So everything I'm working on at the moment feels way better than everything I've ever worked on before.
Yeah.
And that's about all we have time for on Unspeakable this, month? I guess is what we're saying. Visit us at unspeakableoath.com and make sure if you're listening to this on iTunes or if you have iTunes to head on over to the iTunes directory and rate us.
That's under the iTunes store and look for podcast.
Exactly.
So you can just then search for Unspeakable and it'll pull up our little podcast, and then you can rate it and review it and say,
and the better ratings and reviews we have, the more likely it will be to pop up for people who don't know that it's there.
Yes.
And then we'll get more listeners, and then it'll be more awesome for everyone.
Exactly. So anyway,
that's what we want.
All right. So this is Ross Payton
and Shane Ivey. Thank you very much, guys, for coming in.
No problem, and this is Torrin Atkinson, and we'll see you next time on Unspeakable.